Ian Lee, Saturdays,
9 till 12. BBC WM
95.6.
Morning, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Nick Conrad, who's still poorly. The last I heard was glandular fever. Oh, dear, if that's the case, get well at your leisure, because that takes ages. I'm here between 9 and 12. Thanks very much to Molly. Lots to talk about this morning. We'll be discussing aren't you excited that Doctor Who's on tonight? 50th anniversary? Come on, have a soul. I can't believe there's anybody listening to this who doesn't love a little bit of Doctor Who. If you're not looking forward to it, shame on you. Shame on you. We'll talk about that a bit later on. We'll also be talking about, someone has called for all criminal investigations into bombings related to Northern Ireland before the Good Friday Agreement. Well, they should be abandoned. No prosecution should be made. What are your thoughts on that, particularly the powerful anniversary for the people of Birmingham? But before we get to that, the government's chief legal advisor, Dominic Grieve, has said that the Pakistani community, amongst others, is corrupt. Do you agree?
Call 08453
009956. Ian Lee on BBC WM
95.6.
Now, the way this show works, if you are new to this or if you're a regular, let me just remind you, I need you to kind of get in touch with me. Otherwise, it's just me sat here talking to myself, which would be fun, but it would be more fun if you take part. Lots of ways you can get in touch. You can email me directly, ian.lee, I-A-I-N.L-E-E, at bbc.co.uk. You can send me a text, 81333 WM. The best way, though, because I think with some of these things, it's okay you firing a statement at me on a tweet or on a text and then dashing off, but some of these I think require a little bit of exploration today. We need to look at some of these quite deeply. I don't think we can deal with certainly most of these issues today with just a knee-jerk one-sentence answer. So if you want to give me a call today, 08453 00 9956, 08453 00 9956, and you can call in any time you want. The lines are free. Someone's calling now. Most of the lines are free, so now's a cracking time to call in. And the first story we're talking about, front page of the Daily Telegraph, there's the headline: Minister, corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. Ouch. Now, I know there's a huge Pakistani community here, but let's ask the question: are you corrupt? Seems simple to me. The government's chief legal advisor has said politicians need to wake up to the problem of corruption among ethnic minorities. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph, the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, said he was referring mainly to the Pakistani community. He also singles out the Indian community as it not being a problem there. He said, I'm not talking about Indians, it's mainly the Pakistani community. Well, is it true? Here's the question. Is the Pakistani community corrupt? Let's put it out there and let's see where we get with that. I know we've got a huge Pakistani community listening. I spent 3 months in Pakistan, so I sort of have a little bit more knowledge than perhaps that you might expect. And also, is it right for Dominic Grieve, a man who's in a position of power, he's got the front page of the Daily Telegraph, is it right for him to say something like that? Well, the Labour MP for Birmingham, Birmingham Perry Barr, Khalid Mahmood, says he's horrified by the comment.
He says that the Pakistani community is corrupt, more corrupt than all the other BME community. And what this is about is setting the target to dividing within the communities, divide and conquer. So in the article, he also says, well, the Indian community is all right, but it's just the Pakistani community.
He does make that differentiation, just to heighten any possible tensions between Indians and Pakistanis. What do you think? Two things, I guess, really. Is the Pakistani community corrupt? And was Dominic Grieve, is it right that someone in his position should say those things? 08453 00 9956. It does seem to be an incredibly sweeping statement. We'll go through the actual Telegraph and the story and some more of his quotes a little bit later on to see if we can find out a bit more. We did ask Dominic Grieve, the Attorney General, to come on the programme. He's not available to speak to us this morning. His spokesperson has sent us a statement saying he was not singling out any one ethnic community. Well, I'm joined now by Councillor Wasim Zafar. He is the Chair of the Social Cohesion Scrutiny Committee at Birmingham City Council. Good morning, Wasim.
Good morning.
What do you make of Mr. Grieve's comments? The Pakistani community is corrupt.
this is a totally outrageous, baseless statement from the most senior lawyer in Her Majesty's government. I think he's brought Her Majesty's government into disrepute. I think the Prime Minister has no option to sack, other than just sack Dominic Grieve. His position is totally untenable. I think to make such a... And the fact that this individual, apparently, according to his Wikipedia profile, was in charge of community cohesion for some time for the Conservative Party, clearly conveys to me he's not fit for purpose. He shouldn't be having such a senior role in government. He's, as Khalid Mahmood has clearly said, this is a case of divide and rule, and he's racist. As far as it's a racist statement, unless he can provide evidence to us that the 1.2 million British Pakistanis that live in the United Kingdom are corrupt, it's a racist statement. There's many sections of society, including the British Pakistani community, who make a huge social and economic contribution to making this a great country. I think there's an issue of corruption in many sections of society, not just the ethnic minorities, and certainly not just in the Pakistani community.
He does, just again looking at this front page of the Telegraph, he does single out an example, an election in Slough in Berkshire, which is where I grew up and has a huge Pakistani community, where abuses occur. Just reading from the paper, in 2008, a Tory councillor, Eshak Khan, was found guilty of fraud involving postal ballots.
There have been many other politicians from all communities who have been convicted of such things. A few weeks ago, there was a conviction up in Stoke. A elected councillor was convicted for taking money from the Labour Party. And the other thing we need to focus on is, why is it a criminal cannot just be labelled as a criminal? If somebody's been convicted of a crime, they need to be categorized as a criminal. And why is it that their ethnicity or their faith needs to be included in these statements? Right? As far as I'm concerned, if this individual was convicted, he's a convicted criminal. It doesn't need to be stated that he's a Pakistani criminal or a Muslim criminal.
Well, what Mr. Grieve is the reason he's stating the Pakistani, singling them out, he says because we have minority communities. This is a quote from him: we have minority communities in this country which come from backgrounds where corruption is endemic. Is it fair to say that corruption is endemic within Pakistan itself?
I think there's an issue of corruption in Pakistan, but I don't live in Pakistan. I was born here in Birmingham, like many of the 1.2 million British Pakistanis, born, brought up in this culture, very much integrated into society and into the British way of life. And we're not corrupt by any means. And I can assure you, many of the 1.2 million British Muslims and British Pakistanis that live in the United Kingdom are doing some fantastic work. Are professionals who are exceeding life. There's people who sit in the same House of Commons with Dominic Grieve, who are holding very, very important positions. His colleague, Baroness Saida Varsi, is a member of the British Pakistani community. Is she corrupt? Is Sadiq Khan, the Shadow Lord Chancellor, is he corrupt? What is Dominic Grieve trying to get at here?
There is. I worked in Pakistan only for 3 months, but I got to witness deals between a big film company and Pakistani officials in the police and the government, and there was a little bit of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Money being exchanged in brown envelopes. There is an element of corruption within Pakistan itself, isn't there? Within the police and with the government.
I'm sorry, if you speak to some of the Pakistanis who live in Pakistan, they'll point a finger at us and at the expenses scandal.
Yep.
The expenses scandal where MPs were caught red-handed, some of them convicted, from all sections of society, they're from all communities, right? They had their hands in the public purse and clearly conveyed that there were issues within the expenses system in the House of Commons. They will point fingers at that. So there's corruption in all forms of society, in every country in the world, right? In developing countries, as you mentioned, in Pakistan and some areas of Africa, as well as developed countries. And that was clearly proven during the MP's expenses scandal. I think holding such a senior role, is the most senior lawyer in Her Majesty's government, and for him to make this outrageous comment at an incredibly sensitive time, because I'm telling you one thing, there is a rise, unfortunately, in Islamophobia. The Muslim community and the Pakistani community are being attacked, and it's up to the government and institutions such as Birmingham City Council, others, as we as a council are clearly doing, to support these communities, rather than making these comments to journalists and ending up on the front pages of these newspapers.
Wasim, do you think the Attorney General's position is tenable?
He has to resign, or David Cameron has to sack him, as far as I'm concerned.
Councillor Wasim Safar, thank you very much indeed. Chair of the Social Cohesion Scrutiny Community at Birmingham City Council. There's a tongue twister if ever there was one. Thank you very much indeed. Is he right? Dominic Grieve has to go. Either by hook or by crook, he has to go. Is he push or is he? Does he jump? 08453 009956 is the telephone number. If you want to give us a call on that, what do you think? He's got a point. It's a tough one, isn't it? I have witnessed corruption in Pakistan, but as our guest just said there, Wasim said, yeah, and there's corruption here, and there is, isn't there? What's his mistake in mentioning one particular ethnic community? Right, let's have, by the way, this is Ian Lee, BBC WM, sitting in for Nick Conrad here in 12. Shall we have a grown-up discussion about this? The front page of The Telegraph, Minister, corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. Is he right? Now, I suspect we will get lots of Pakistani people phoning up saying, no, of course it's not right, it's unfair. 08453 009956. If you are not a member of the Pakistan community, Indian or whatever you may be, white, whatever, what do you think? Is Dominic Grieve saying what you've been thinking? Or do you think you sound like an out-and-out racist by coming out and saying that? 08453 009956. I'm keen to get as many sides to this argument as possible. Maybe you're sat there, you've got your Telegraph, you're eating your Weetabix, and you've gone, at last, someone spotted what I've been saying for the last 30 years. Or maybe you're choking on your cornflakes going, flip it, has he actually said that? Has he actually come out and said that? What a muppet. It's not 1976. 08453 009956 is the telephone number. Mohammed and Doreen will come to you in a bit, but first of all, I'm going to go to Shafiq in Warsaw. Morning, Shafiq.
Good morning.
Morning, Shafiq. What do you reckon about what Dominic Grieve said? The Pakistan community is corrupt.
Councillor Wasim actually have spoken quite eloquently, and he have addressed many issues. In addition to that, I can add that it's not about the corruption. It is about the make of a community. For example, in Pakistani community, family politics is one of the things that is real, that a certain family would favor certain political parties.
What do you mean family politics? If the dad votes Labour, they'll all vote Labour.
If father votes Labour, and the children probably will vote Labour. If the mother votes the Tories, and the others will probably follow the suit. It is because in Pakistani household, political discussion is always on a table. It's not, you know, the Pakistani community don't talk about the soccer and the pub culture.
Right.
So it is.
But that's quite often the same in other communities, though, isn't it? If mum and dad vote one party, then you'll either rebel and vote the opposite, or you'll kind of carry on voting theirs. That's unique to Pakistan.
But can I also add that what the council, in addition to the council, seems a comment that he mentioned about the expenses. What about the cash for owners? I mean, who promotes that? Isn't that mainly the Tories?
But it's not the same, is it?
Isn't that blatant corruption?
It's not because the same as the example.
You are bringing your favourite people in a limelight. No community, I think, should be targeted like that. You need to, like you said, you lived in Pakistan for three months, and you have studied. You have probably studied, and get insight about the politicians And you have also probably studied about the insight of a common person. A common person in any community is not corrupt.
But the officials I saw in Pakistan, I was there for 3 months, but I did get to see a few politicians. I did get to see how things were moved on quickly with cash. I got to see a really important copper at a party in Pakistan smoking a joint. Now, that's not particularly, that it seemed to be that corruption was endemic within that society. And a different corruption to, you know, people paying a few thousand pounds and maybe becoming a lord or getting an MBE or something. This was important people that were doing bent stuff and taking backhanders.
I didn't say that doesn't happen. In a Pakistani political circle, there is the culture of corruption, but we are talking about Britain, that a common person is not corrupt. I mean, for example, when there was an interview with the Councillor Khalid Mahmood, he said, you know, about the postal vote, there can be a rigging, and that can happen. I believe you, it happens on both sides.
Shafiq, thank you very much for your time. 08453-00956. He thinks it's an unfair statement, and corruption is everywhere. It's just perhaps a slightly different kind of corruption. Well, I'm joined now by Khalid Mahmood. He's the Labour MP for Perry Bar. Morning, Khalid.
Morning.
Dominic Grieve, front page of the Daily Telegraph. Corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. What do you reckon?
Well, I'm very, very disappointed that he picks out one community and without providing any statistical evidence of how he's arrived at this. And then he says there are other communities that are culpable as well. The Anglo-Saxon community is culpable as well. So he paints his broad brush, but then picks out one community, and I think that's unfair. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and give you examples of other communities, because that's the line that he wants to go down, and I think it's unfair that he's done that from a position that he's in, particularly being the law officer, without any real statistical evidence to back it up. And I also think that this is part of an election agenda for the Conservatives coming up now to the next election. And it's always an issue around race that starts to move in that particular direction. They're running away from the UKIP party, and in order to try and stand tougher than they are, he's brought this issue out.
He says here, this is a quote from him, he's the MP for Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. He's got a sizeable South Asian community. I can see many of them have come because of the opportunities that they get, but they also come from societies where they've been brought up to believe you can only get certain things through a favour culture. A favour culture. That does sum up the Pakistani the ethic, ethos in Pakistan, doesn't it?
Well, it's not just Pakistan, and you know this because you've been there and you know what it's like. It's not just Pakistan. There are other Southeast Asian. I mean, see, what I don't want to do is this: get drawn into this discussion of who's worse corrupt than who, whether India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, wherever else, Bangladesh, whatever else you want to look at. Those are the issues that I don't want. This is a deliberate target by him in order to get at what he wants to get at, and that's exactly what he's done. And what we've got to do is look at how the Prime Minister can actually now look at this and either agree with him or disagree with him, because he's his law officer and he's made this statement. And so the Tory party has got to either own it or disown it. And that's what they need to do, and they're not doing that at the moment.
We spoke earlier on in the show to Councillor Wasim Zafar. He said that Dominic Grieve, his position is untenable. He has to go.
Well, I think certainly, it's something that needs to be looked at. I think for Dominic to consider himself the statement that he's made, I think it's a retrograde statement that he's made. I think it's out of character for him, and I think certainly it pushes it towards an election campaign. And you know, he singles out one community, which is, he says it doesn't affect that community. Is that because his constituency is predominantly from that community? You know, and I think this is a very, very biased statement that he's made. And I think it leaves all proper channels behind. And he's done it in a very, very odd fashion.
Is it a racist statement, Khalid?
Well,
If it was just one community, you could say that. But what he does do is point out to other community, but then comes back to that community.
He says it's mainly the Pakistani community. It's mainly the Pakistani community. Is that racist?
Well, I said that, you know, you can't say that without backing it up statistically.
So it is racist.
And yes, I think ultimately, yes, it is.
Khalid, thank you very much indeed. That's Khalid Mahmood, Labour MP for Perry Barr. Why am I having trouble saying Perry Barr this morning? Perry Barr, Perry Barr, Perry Barr. Saying that Dominic Grieve, it's a racist statement. Corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. It's an incredible thing. Yes, it's mainly, this is Mr. Grieve, it's mainly the Pakistani community, not the Indian community. Isn't it odd that he differentiates between the two? And I'm trying to think, Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire, it's quite white, Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. I know my mum lives very near there. I don't think there's a particularly big Pakistani community or an Indian community. What do you think? Anyway, is he being racist? Let's try that, shall we? That's what Khalid Mahmood seems to think, that it's a racist statement. Do you agree? 08453-00956. Speaking of racist statements, a little bit later, in about 5-10 minutes time, we'll be talking about a note that was sent out to some parents of school children talking about a trip to a mosque, saying that the children would be branded racist if they didn't attend a school trip to a mosque. So keep that in the back of your minds. I know, it's incredible, isn't it? Keep that in the back of your minds. Is Dominic Grieve's statement that corruption is rife in the Pakistani community, is it racist? 08453-00956. Doreen, you've been waiting for ages. You're very patient. Doreen in Erdington. Good morning.
I told you it was free speech in this country in any case.
No, it's not.
Fends all, please. Everybody says something about somebody that don't suit them. And I don't think it's racist.
Okay, but Doreen, take the Chief Inspector
of Police.
Yes.
It was on in London about the pickpockets.
Yeah.
And what did he say? He said they're mostly... He named the country they come from, Eastern European country.
Yes.
He said, as soon as we get rid of them and tip them back, there's another 5 waiting to come in.
Right.
So you could say he was racist, because he named the country that they come from. I can't remember if it was Romania or Croatia, whatever.
It would appear from that story, though, that he had more statistics to back it up. Mr. Grieve, one second, Doreen. From this interview, from what I've read of this interview, Mr. Grieve doesn't have statistics to back this up.
Well, I thought it was when they tried to fiddle. They tried to fiddle a vote here in Birmingham City, the council.
They
were caught going to people's houses and having the filling the voting for me.
And there's never been that sort of white British. People trying to rig votes?
I've never heard of anybody.
Really?
Got to be honest, no.
We've been hearing about accusations
I don't know, I've never heard.
We're hearing accusations of various trade unions rigging votes, of various members of parliament.
It's like Ireland, they want their own people in, you know. If there was a very good person in, they wouldn't vote for them because he's not probably the same ethnic or religion as them. Well, that's how it is in Northern Ireland, like, based on... you know, if you're a Catholic, you can't have that job. And, you know, I think that some of these, that can be a bit like that, you know.
Do you not think, though, that
I think the younger generation have probably got more sense.
Can you hear me, Doreen?
The older generation are a bit still... haven't branched out, so to speak.
Can you hear me, Doreen?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering why you were talking when I was. But surely, if the Pakistani community, they would want the person who is best for them, wouldn't they? They're not
But not if it was probably, say, it was a Sikh or a Hindu.
Oh, yeah.
And they got a Pakistani. I think they'd vote for the Pakistani.
Do you think Pakistanis are corrupt, Doreen?
Say. 100%, but I think they would.
Do you think Pakistan...
That'd be clannish. Oh, that's the word
Doreen.
I'm looking for.
Yes. Do you think Pakistanis are corrupt?
I don't know.
Do you...
There's corruption everywhere.
Yes.
The cricket, the Pakistani cricket crime was corrupt, wasn't
that? But hang on,
then
Doreen.
Then you've got the other part, Doreen, corrupt as well.
Doreen, but then you say the Pakistani cricket team, but in the past the Australian cricket team have been corrupt. The English cricket team. So maybe...
You know, it does spread about a bit.
Maybe the issue here is that Dominic Grieve shouldn't have singled out the Pakistani community.
Well, if he'd said probably on what they'd done, like probably the voting, probably it was proved, I don't know. there we are. If you know, it's like the police officers said, the Eastern Europeans did most of the pickpocketing in London.
Doreen, thank you very much indeed. We kind of got somewhere in the end. I'm not quite sure where. We kind of got somewhere. 08453 009956. The initial point she made there, isn't it? Surely we have free speech in this country. No. People on phone-in shows. But hang on, where's my free speech? You don't have free speech on a phone-in show. Of course you don't. Of course you don't. In as much as you can't come on and libel somebody, and you can't come on and swear. So there's your free speech out the window. Doesn't exist. 08453 009956. Dominic Grief, he said corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. Is he right? And is it a racist statement to say that? 08453 009956. You can text 81333. Start your text WM. You can send me an email as well. Ian.lee, IAIN.LEE at bbc.co.uk. Ranjit's in Albury. Morning, Ranjit.
Hiya, mate. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. The Pakistani community is corrupt.
It's gutter politics by Dominic Green. That's all I can say, right? He probably isn't racist, but he's playing the race card to divide the people. There's corruption everywhere in the world. I'm Indian. I was born in England, but I'm of Indian origin, yeah? There is corruption in India and in Pakistan. The thing is, in India and Pakistan, the corruption's on top of the table. So you name your price, you get your thing done. There's corruption in this country, but it's under the table. That's the only difference. Yeah? I can give you a good example of corruption that's happening right in front of us, right in front of our nose, all the time, and nobody says nothing about it. This overseas aid to India, that we're giving £800 million, that's a bribe to the Indian government or to the Indian economy to keep Jaguar Land Rover here. Why doesn't anybody say Cameron's corrupt because he's giving overseas aid? Why are they singling Pakistani people out or Asian people or black people? All they're trying to do is divide the society. Yesterday it was the Romanian gypsies. Today it's the Pakistanis. Tomorrow it might be the Indians. After that it might be the black people. It's always something or another. Why don't they sort their economics out? That is the biggest problem today in this country.
Ranjit, thank you very much indeed. 08453 009956. Dominic Grief, is it a racist statement? Do you agree with him? Is the Pakistani community corrupt? Morning, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Nick. The way this show works is we kind of throw lots of bits and pieces out and we chat about them and we think about them, and you can call in at any point in the show about things we've talked about. Doctor Who's coming up very soon, I promise. But you can still call in about Dominic Grieve and his statements about the Pakistani community. 08453 009956. Kind of a related issue, this next story. How racist can young children be? If you're 8, can you be racist? You can use the language, but does an 8-year-old have the knowledge of where that language comes from? What it means? Well, have a listen to this. The head teacher of a Cannock school has had to apologise after parents objected to a letter which suggested children would be racist if they didn't attend a school trip to a mosque. The visit by pupils at Littleton Green Community School in Huntingdon is due to form part of the parents' cultural education. Angry mums and dads threatened to keep their youngsters away from school that day in protests after the headmistress said a permanent note would be put on a pupil's record if they didn't go to the mosque. I have the letter here, okay? This letter was sent out to parents of kids at a school. Have a listen to this. Dear parent, as part of the National Religious Education Curriculum, together with the multicultural community in which we live, it's a statutory requirement for primary school-aged children to experience and learn about different cultures. So far, so good. Makes sense, doesn't it? The workshop is at Staffordshire University and will give your child the opportunity to explore other religions. Children will be looking at religious artefacts similar to those that will be on display in a museum. They will not be partaking in any religious practice. Right, okay. So they're not going to be praying to any, you know, in inverted commas, foreign gods. They're just going to be going and looking and touching and listening and learning. Then it starts to get interesting. Refusal to allow your child to attend this trip will result in a racial discrimination note being attached to your child's education record, which will remain on this file throughout their school career. A racial discrimination note. All absences on this day will be investigated for their credibility and will only be sanctioned with a GP sick note. Yours sincerely, Mrs. Small, head teacher. Wow. Now I'm trying to think how I've got two young lads. If a note like that came home, I mean, yes, I'd want my children to go. Of course I want my children to go and look at other religions and other communities and the gods that they pray to. But the threat that if they didn't go, it would result in a racial discrimination note being attached to my child's education record. 08453 009956. Are you shocked by this? This does to me seem incredible. The teacher, the headmistress, Lynn Small, apologised and wrote to parents again asking them to disregard what she had said. Oh, I bet she did. Oh, I bet she did. 08453 009956. Jeff Ashley is the Labour councillor for the Huntington Ward and a former chair of the school's governors. Jeff, what's your reaction to this letter from headteacher Mrs. Small?
Hello, Ian.
Hello.
First of all, I was very disturbed when I did receive a copy of this letter via the Express and Star yesterday. I'd agree with your sentiment that initially, yeah, okay, I think it's extremely useful if 8, 9 and 10-year-olds attend these sort of classes to look at religions and cultures that are, well, prevalent in our country. But then to go on to say that a child's record will have a racial discriminant note attached to it throughout its child's career, I think is going way over the top. And unfortunately, I think that Lynn Small's made a very serious mistake on this one. And I am pleased, incidentally, that she has apologised and withdrawn those comments.
What is, Jeff, it's been a long, my kids are sort of at the play school age, so the nursery age, so they're not quite at school. A racial discrimination note attached to your school record. What exactly would a teacher a few years down the line interpret from that?
Exactly. I think this is the point. Well, hopefully that the child itself, and let's face it, primary school children are very vulnerable. They want to learn, they like to learn, and they do what their teachers tell them.
Mm.
Now, I don't think the discrimination note was aimed specifically at children. It was aimed at the parents. But, of course, it's the children's record that is smeared with this particular note. And I think it's wrong. It really is. And if I may say so, within the village, I think the brown, smelly stuff has really hit the fan on this one. And, you know, obviously it's up now to the governing body to decide what action they may wish to take on the matter.
Do you think Mrs. Small should go?
No, it's not for me to say that. All I'm saying is that now, really, it has got into the national press, I understand, as well. You know, really, there's some serious discussion needs to be taken by the governing body on this one. And, of course, the education department at Staffordshire County Council.
And those bodies could ask for, if they wanted to step down if they thought it was appropriate.
Well, that, again, as I've said, Ian, is entirely up to them. But I was very disturbed by this letter.
What could have been going through her mind, Jeff, when she wrote, if refusal to allow your child to attend will result in a racial discrimination note that will remain on their file throughout their school career? What was she thinking?
Exactly. I really don't know. I mean, obviously, Lynn wanted all children that could possibly attend to go, and I think we all agree with that sentiment.
Mm.
But to put it in these terms, all that she's done now is put the backs up of many parents in the village. And may I say this, that I would still like to suggest to parents that may be very upset by this to still send their children to this particular seminar in spite of the so-called threat in the letter, because it is part and a serious part of the child's education.
You're right, and I think it would be a shame for a parent to throw a hissy fit and stop their children from going, because I do think stuff like this is how we're going to sort out problems, you know, in 20, 30 years down the line. It's education around different communities and different religions, I think, would go a long way towards sorting this out. What is the feeling of the parents, Jeff? Have you spoken to them?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't. I know some of them, because there's been a big article on the front of the Express and Star last night. I know some of them, and I can understand their feelings. But let me say this, Ian. I have not been directly approached by parents, because as I've said, I'm not on the governing body at the present time, you know. But no, I can still get the feeling within the village of many parents objections to this kind of letter.
Jeff, I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much indeed. That's Jeff Ashley. He's the Labour councillor for the Huntington Ward. Just have a think about this for a second. And these two stories do kind of weave their ways into each other, don't they? They both involve the R word to a certain extent. Is it racist? Are these racist? Refusal to allow your children to attend this trip will result in a racial discrimination note. Well, what do you think? First of all, let's start low level, okay? Jeff said there that no one would object, no one in their right mind would object to their child going to study other religions. Well, let's ask. Would you object if your kids or your grandkids got a note from school that said, oh, we're going to go and look at a mosque, we're going to go and study Hinduism and Sikhs? Would you be offended by that? I wish I'd done more of that when I was at school. We did a bit, and I said I grew up in Slough, big Indian and Pakistani community, so I kind of knew about what was going on. But we didn't go to a mosque when I was at school. We didn't go to the Sikh temple. There's a huge Sikh temple around the corner. Could have gone there off my own bat, I suppose. But we didn't as part of the school. So would you be offended if the school suggested that your kids or your grandkids had to go to look at other religions, other places of worship? 08453 009956. And then let's take it to the next stage. If the letter then said they would be branded racist for their entire school record, how would that make you feel? 08453 009956 is the telephone number. 8333 is the text number if you want to text in. WM, start your text, please. You can also email me, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. I can see the phones are going bonkers. Marlene, Jean, Alan, Brian, stay there. We'll come after you. Come to you straight after we get the travel.
Call 08453 009956.
Ian Lee on BBC WM
95.6.
That's the phone number. Lots of you are calling in, so let's get straight to it. Marlene's in Wolverhampton. Good morning, Marlene.
Good morning.
What would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to say from her point of view, Mrs. Small, is it?
This is Mrs. Small. She's the head teacher of Littleton Green Community School.
I think she made an error of statement. Unfortunately, she sent out a letter that she knew what she wanted to say, but she said it in the completely wrong way, and it inflamed people. Now, from the parents' point of view, they could have decided, right, we're going to take a mass grievance, whatever. She's very lucky, actually, that they haven't done that, because from the point of view of the letter, it was wrong. It was a wrong thing to put in the letter, because people do get incensed by that kind of wording. It's just not right. You can't put that sort of thing there. She should have said that, you know, we'd be happy, you know, to entertain pupils who feel they don't want to go or whatever, and then discuss it. But you certainly can't say, put that, and you can't put that on a child's record anyway. It's just not possible. You can't put that racial discrimination on a child's record. It won't follow them through. It really has no clout. So I don't know why she did it in the first place.
You say she's made a mistake, but she's a head teacher.
She is a head teacher.
She should have written that note and then reread it and then reread it and then shown it to someone.
And she doesn't even have to do that. She can pass it on to her secretary. And, you know, we all have, with head of departments, you've got secretaries. And your secretary can say to you, you know what, I don't think that was worded quite rightly, because they look at it from a different perspective, you know. They haven't got the education that they have, that a head teacher has. So they look at it on a layman's point of view. So her secretary or her deputy could have said, you know what, I don't, because there's no way that everybody would have agreed with that letter. Somebody must have said, I don't think that's the right thing. She probably was warned, but she went ahead with it anyway. And that kind of, to say that, to put on the record, I can't see how she sanctioned that on her own. You can't just sanction that and say, right, we're going to do this. Because that is an education thing. That is not something she can decide just on her own. That is going to be an education department decision to put something on a child's record. And incidentally, as I said, you can't do that. I don't know where she's coming from with that.
It says here, it's compulsory for primary school children to experience and learn about different cultures. It's compulsory.
It is compulsory, but it's not compulsory that you have to actually go into the mosque. You don't have to. You have to learn about it. Mm. But learning about it could be a remote thing in that you do it in the school. But you don't have to go to a mosque. So I could say, I don't feel I want my child to go there, please. But what I will do is I'm quite happy for them to learn about that particular religion in the school setting. So they're quite within their rights to say, no, we don't want to go. However, we know it's compulsory. We don't want our child to go there. But I don't know any parent that would do that.
I was about to say, Marlene, why would anyone not want their child to go to a mosque or a church or a temple?
They wouldn't. However, you know how people's minds work. You say to them, there is a consequence, and people switch. There is a switch in their brain that says, bring it on. That's all these parents are saying, bring it on.
I have the bring it on switch in my head, and I'm trying to get it disconnected because it just gets me in trouble.
Well, exactly, and I'm the same. You give me a consequence, I would have been fine if you'd have said, we would really like, and we think it's a good experience for your child, and we will try and make it as fulfilling as possible. That would have been a better thing to put, and they would have thought, you know what, that sounds really nice. But no, she had to incense everybody by putting on that letter. And for me, I know what I would have done. I'd have been like, I'd like to see you try, bring it on.
Marlene, thank you for... Marlene's very much like me. I have that attitude, that switch. Yeah, you reckon? Right, let's roll up our sleeves and slug this one out. Marlene, thank you very much indeed. 08453-009956. Is there anybody listening who wouldn't want their children or their grandchildren to go and visit a place of worship that wasn't their, you know, their original religion? A church, a mosque, a temple, a synagogue? Why would you not want to? I'm genuinely curious as to why you wouldn't want your kids to go to a place of worship that wasn't connected with your particular religious faith. Why? What harm could it do? It can only do good, can't it? 08453-009956. Gavin Williamson is the Conservative MP for South Staffordshire. Good morning, Gavin.
Morning.
Gavin, what do you make of this letter?
Well, I think Marlene's got it sort of absolutely spot on, really, hasn't she? I think everyone wants to sort of have a better understanding, or most people want to have a better understanding of different people's faiths. But I think it was the issue of the threat and the cajoling. And I can quite understand many of my constituents feeling very angry about that, because it wasn't the right way of doing it. And, you know, it's sort of, I'm just very glad that they've seen sense and actually made sure that they've adopted a totally different approach now and dropped this sort of threatening way, because it's just not the way to engage with parents and children. And children, it's a very rough deal for the child, who ultimately will have no say over that, and then potentially have had something on their records forevermore while they're in education.
Have you spoken, have people been in touch with you to bring this matter to your attention?
They have. A lot of people were very, very angry and just sort of felt that it was just the wrong way of going about things. And the school is ultimately very much the heart of any community, and you really want to always be bringing along the parents and the pupils with you on this matter. But I think what we should remember is that, you know, action's been taken, you know, the head teachers acted, you know, made sure that she's listened to local concerns and sort of made sure that we've got this put right.
You described her as bonkers.
I think it is a bonkers idea to go and sort of go around threatening people with that. I think it's totally and utterly bonkers. I think most people would agree, because actually, as has been said by your listeners, actually, if you put it in a positive way, most people would want that to their children to have that experience. As someone who has two daughters, I've quickly worked out that they're very good at manipulating me and making sure that I do exactly what they want to do without any sort of threats at all. So it's often just about the approach, and I think it was a very a totally and utterly bonkers approach to have, but I'm glad that it's been put right.
And has Mrs. Small, the headmistress, sorted this to your satisfaction? Is she going to be able to move on from this, do you think?
Of course, it has been sorted out, which I think everyone welcomes. I don't think any of your listeners, and I certainly myself, and maybe even yourself, sometimes make mistakes.
Never, Gavin. I've never made a mistake.
I'm pleased to hear that someone is perfect. Yes. Well, I certainly have made mistakes, and I'm sure many of your listeners have. But it actually is, if you make a mistake, it's what you do to try and put it right. And this seems to have been put right, and I think that we need to then move on and actually get on. This is a really good local school, and silly things happened, that's been put right, and then it's about moving forward and building people's faith and trust back up.
Gavin, thank you very much indeed. Gavin Williamson, Conservative MP for South Staffordshire, 08453 009956. Tracy, morning Tracy.
Morning.
Tracy, you're a parent from this, whose child goes to this school, is that right?
I am, yes.
Ah, I see. Okay. Now, when did you get the letter?
The letter was sent out on... the letter was originally sent out last week.
Okay.
But the letter that said that we were going to get the racial discrimination letter sent was also... there was a week gone. If we didn't send our child, we were going to get their child was going to get discrimination notes.
How many kids have you got at Littleton Green Community School, and how old are they?
Two, and one's eight and one's nine. But this only applied for years 4, 5, and 6.
What age does that mean? Because I always get confused with these years nowadays.
4, 5, and 6. That's like at year 8, 9, and 10.
Okay, right. Okay.
Sorry, ages 8, 9, and 10. Sorry.
Okay. So when you got this letter, what did you think when you read it?
I was absolutely fuming by it. Absolutely fuming. So for your child to have a discrimination letter put upon his note when he hadn't had a choice in it anyway, it was just bonkers. Absolutely. I've never heard of it before.
And did you speak to any of the other parents?
I spoke to a lot of parents that didn't wish for their children to go. But when we went and confronted the head teacher, we were told that we had no choice. And then I also said that the kids wouldn't have these notes put on, and she used the words and called me racist. So,
wow, Mrs. Small called you racist.
She did, yeah. And really, she's the head teacher. She's a qualified. She should know that Islam is not a race. So,
why would you not want your children to go and study other religions?
Mainly that religion. It's their way of life. I mean, I don't want my kids to know any way of life what they get up to. If it had been somewhere else, it might have been a completely different matter. But Islamic Workshop, no.
Why? Can I ask why not?
Well, it's just their way of life, isn't it? The things they do.
What things they do that you don't want your children to become aware of?
Well, they're allowed to have sex at an unreasonable age, at 9 years old.
Right.
It's just the way they are.
They wouldn't be teaching that, would they? They wouldn't be saying sex at 9 years old
that.
And...
But that's their way of life, isn't it? You know, that's what concerned me. And last year, when the older year sixes went to this thing, she swore down that they wouldn't be involved in anything. Now, these year six that went actually had to wear the hats and they practice out sitting on prey mats and everything. That's absolutely outrageous.
Why is... because when you enter a place of worship that requires the covering of the head, you do cover the head. Why is that outrageous to ask children just to put a hat on? It doesn't mean they've converted or anything, does it?
No, it doesn't mean anything. I'm the parent. I just don't want my children around Islam, knowing anything about Islamic. It just doesn't make sense. We're Christians. You don't see Islamic people going into a Christian church or they're allowed to opt out of these things. I mean, I've got a Muslim friend down in Cannock, and her kids go to a Cannock school. Their children do not have to go to assembly. They can sit out of that assembly every morning because they're not allowed in.
When did you and your kids last go to a church?
To a church? Oh, gosh, my kids go to church with their dad every week. I mean, he's a gypsy, so, you know, they're well into the church, isn't
they? The thing isn't part of the problem, because I've not heard this thing about Islamists having sex at the age of 9. I was unaware of that. If that is indeed,
everybody knows that.
I didn't know that, and I'm not with the greatest respect. I'm not 100% convinced that's true. But isn't that the problem? Is that I didn't get to go to a mosque when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, and maybe if I did, and maybe if you did, Tracy, then we would know the truth about Islam, and we wouldn't be so afraid of it.
But then, shouldn't that work for everybody then?
That's it should.
And you know, if you see, when you start seeing Islamic people going into Christian churches and Catholic churches, then bloody hell, by God, then we'll all have to have that. You know, they don't have to do what they don't want to do, you know.
So is that it? I think we're getting somewhere, Tracy. Is that it? Is it jealousy on your part that you...
I wouldn't say so much jealousy, because how can you get jealous about them, you know. It's not jealousy, it's just... It's really odd, isn't it? You know, we don't have an option, and then we get threatening letters being called racist. Now, come on, I'm not racist. I'm far from racist.
And I'm not saying this for a second. Let me play devil's advocate. There will be some people listening to this, Tracy, who think that what you're saying is possibly not racist, but certainly bigoted and ill-informed. What would you say to those people who think that?
That's their opinion. That really is their opinion. Look, I'm born British, and that's just me.
So are lots of Muslims.
Wow. Then they should live by our rules, then, shouldn't they?
And what
Instead
are
they our,
what,
trying to convert us?
What are our rules?
And getting us to go into mosques and, you know. Well, for one, I mean, they don't like Christmas. It won't be long before we don't get Christmases on that.
Tracy, listen, we have to end it there. I don't think Christmas is in danger of disappearing. Certainly not in my house. That ain't going nowhere. Tracy, with some very strong views there. Dare I suggest it, quite a lot of them ill-informed, bigoted. Would you go as far as racist? 08453 009956. Coming up, we'll be talking about some rather controversial statements about Northern Ireland and people who committed the atrocities there. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Nick Conrad on BBC WM.
Ian Lee, Saturdays
9 till 12. BBC WM
95.6.
Good morning, this is Ian Lee, BBC WM 95.6. Nick is still poorly. He's got glandular fever, so, I mean, he could be out for ages. Bless him, Nick. Get well soon. Lots to talk about. We'll carry on with your phone calls about Dominic Grieve, saying corruption is rife in the Pakistani community. We'll talk about that school and Mrs. Small, the head teacher, who said children will be branded racist if they didn't go on to a religious visit. We just spoke to one caller who doesn't want her children to visit a mosque, because Islamese, her word, are disgusting. Is that fair? Doctor Who is coming up as well. But in this hour of the show, I'm keen to get your thoughts. Well, an incredible statement by a top lawyer in Northern Ireland claiming for an amnesty on people who committed atrocities before the Good Friday Agreement. 08453 009956.
Call 08453 009956.
Ian Lee on BBC WM
95.6.
Well, it really is an apt time to be discussing this, what with the West Midlands, which have been mourning the 39th anniversary of the Birmingham bombings. The top lawyer in Northern Ireland has proposed an end to prosecutions related to the Troubles. Now, I know there'll be lots of people listening to this who were affected by those bombings 39 years ago, so I'm really keen to get your thoughts on this. You can also comment as well if you weren't personally affected. You will have an opinion on this. The plan, which critics claim amounts to an amnesty, would allow perpetrators to come forward without the threat of criminal justice. The Northern Ireland Attorney General, John Larkin, who advises the Belfast government on legal matters, has spoken out to suggest a line should be drawn at the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. Well, the comments came this week as relatives of the 21 people killed on November the 21st, 1974, right here in Birmingham, called for a fresh inquiry into the investigation into their deaths. The six men originally jailed for the terror attacks were freed on appeal after serving 16 years. This might be quite a painful conversation. I hope it's not, but I guess it could be. Is it time to draw a line in the conflict? Should we allow crimes to be solved, even if that comes at the price of sacrificing justice? I guess the thing is, do we move on and turn our back on the past, or do we continually chase justice? 08453 009956. I'll be speaking to family members of people who were lost during that bombing. But earlier on, I spoke to Labour's Ivan Lewis. He's the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And I asked him what he makes of this so-called amnesty proposal.
Well, I think we're quite concerned that the victims are crucial here, and their families, and they need to be put centre stage. And what worries me about the proposal that emerged this week from the Attorney General is that I don't believe it would either deliver truth or justice to the victims. We proposed instead a different process which would make the historic inquiries team much more independent, give it proper powers, we still think there is a need for the organisation or a successor organisation to do those investigations and, if necessary, refer the matters to the police. So I would say that the Attorney General's intervention, whilst he has every right to make it, doesn't respond to the needs and the wishes of the vast majority of victims and their families.
What do you think John Larkin's thinking is behind this? Because it does sound very cold, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the concerns was that the victims' groups in Northern Ireland didn't feel there had been any consultation or engagement with them before the announcement was made. I suspect it was an attempt to move the debate forward, if you like, get people talking, get people debating the issues. And sometimes that's no bad thing. But I do think we have to be incredibly sensitive when we float ideas about how we deal with the past in Northern Ireland. I've only been in this job a relatively short period of time, but it seems to me that there is still a real problem with victims feeling and their families that they've neither had the truth nor have they had justice. Now, we know that victims want very different things, and therefore it's quite difficult to create a system that meets everybody's needs. But we should be seeking to do that, which is why we make some comprehensive recommendations that we released today in our submission to Richard House.
Am I right in thinking that John Larkin is kind of a lone voice in this? He's come out with these comments without the support of the Belfast government, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly decided to make an independent intervention. I don't believe that he speaks for the vast majority of the parties in Northern Ireland, nor, more importantly in this context, the victims and their families groups. But he has a right to say it, and I don't think people should launch personal attacks on him for saying it, but I think we should be very clear in saying if we are going to deal with the past in a way which begins to heal some of the wounds, then the proposal he's made, I'm afraid, is not going to help in that process.
These investigations into to crimes of the past from the 70s and the 80s, it does cost hundreds of millions of pounds, doesn't it? Would you say that was money well spent?
Well, the question really for Northern Ireland is reconciliation and the future. But it seems to me that unless you are seen and in reality deal properly with people's sensibilities about the past, which are perfectly understandable, somebody new to Northern Ireland, as I am, frankly is shocked by the number of families that violence has touched during the Troubles. Now, unless you deal with that trauma, that sense of injustice, the fact that still so many relatives have not had answers, unless you deal with that, it's always going to be quite difficult to move forward. And the big prize, really, is our capacity to support reconciliation and a better future. But unless people feel they have a sense of closure, as I say, some people want truth, other people want truth and justice, it's going to be really difficult to get on with the reconciliation and the vision for the future, the shared vision for the future that everybody wants.
Whatever the financial cost.
Well, when it comes to, I mean, I think, for example, there is a case for saying that other than in exceptional circumstances, we should not go in for these large-scale public inquiries. We're on the record as saying that in the Pat Finucane case, there was a commitment made during the peace process agreement that there should be a full public inquiry, and that should be honoured. But beyond that, I would say to you that only in exceptional circumstances should there be those, vast public inquiries. But in terms of a successor body to the historical inquiries team or a reformed historical inquiries team, I think that is still necessary because there are still too many cases where we haven't had that truth, we haven't had that justice. But also there's a need to look at themes, you know, whether it's state collusion, there's been a lot of disclosures, revelations about that recently, whether it's the activity of specific paramilitary organisations, whether it's truth recovery, which I think has a really important part potentially to play in the future. There is still a need for a body such as the Historical Inquiries Team, albeit much more independent, perhaps with greater powers to do its work. We've said in our recommendation to House that perhaps that body should be time limited, so this doesn't go on forever and ever. But if it's to be time limited, it's got to be given adequate resources, and it's got to have the strong leadership that's necessary. And I don't think it's fair, with all of the challenges that the PSNI face, the wonderful job that they do day in and day out, that they should have to, I think, oversee the historical inquiries process. I think it needs to be independent.
Do you think that there is a point, and this may sound insensitive, but let's put it out, the discussion has been started. Is there a point where justice for victims must be put aside in order to move forward in the peace process?
Well, the two are inextricably linked. I don't think, if there is a sense that justice has not been secured, or truth, and as I say, it's very difficult. Look, some victims just want truth. They don't particularly want accountability for those who are responsible. They just want to know what happened. Others most definitely want both a combination of truth and accountability for those responsible. And there's a small number of relatives who just want to move on and don't necessarily want these things reopening. But the vast majority do want a level of truth and justice. In my view, you can't look at the shared future unless you adequately deal with the past, which is why Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness have asked Richard Haass to do this piece of work. Because I think if you look over the last 15 or 20 years, there is a sense that the past is a thing that has not been adequately and satisfactorily dealt with. Look, in our proposals to Haass, we also make a lot of recommendations about the future. We talk about the concept of a new bank holiday in Northern Ireland to celebrate the progress as a result of the peace process that Northern Ireland has made. This is a world-lauded peace process, and yet in Northern Ireland there seems to be a reluctance to both recognise and celebrate the distance that people have travelled. There's been a lot of progress. We also recommend that there should be a comprehensive post-trauma service in every community, building on the trauma centres that the victims group WAVE have created, because there are so many people in Northern Ireland who are still suffering as a result of either being involved in violence or being victims of violence, or it touching their family, their neighbourhood or their communities.
Ivan Lewis, Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Ivan, that was great. Thanks very much. I really appreciate that. There we go. That was Ivan Lewis, the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. This is going to be an uncomfortable conversation, I would imagine, dear listener. So kind of put your seatbelts on and let's see where we go. And let's try not to take offence at any of it. What do you think about these calls by the Northern Ireland Attorney General, John Larkin? He suggests that there should be, in inverted commas, an amnesty. It's not his word, but it's kind of an easy shorthand we can understand. To draw a line at the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. So anything that happened before then, any of the bombs, any of the killings, the murders, the executions that happened before then, we'd kind of stop investigating. We wouldn't really press charges. 08453 009956. Is that just a completely insensitive, hideous, cold suggestion that goes against British justice and all that is human? Or... do we as a society have to accept that those things happened and move on if we're going to reach a peaceful place? 08453 009956. Stay tuned, because in a second we'll be talking to the brother and sister of someone who was killed in Birmingham all those years ago, and we'll be getting their opinion on that. Well, morning, this is Ian Lee on BBC WM 95.6. 08453 009956, the phone number, 81333, start your text WM, and you can email ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. We're talking about calls for an amnesty for people who committed atrocities before the Good Friday Agreement. What do you think? Sensible or outrageous? 08453 009956. Well, I'm joined now by a brother and sister who both lost their sister in the bombing at the Mulberry Bush. Maxine Hambleton was 18 when she was killed. Her brother Brian and sister Julie are on the line now. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Julie, we'll start with you first. What do you make of John Larkin, the Northern Ireland Attorney General's suggestions?
Can I just correct you? Maxine was in a tavern in the town.
I do apologise. Thank you very much.
With reference to Larkin's comments, I'd just like to read just two things from Justice for Innocent Victims of Terrorism, who are based in Northern Ireland, who represents a whole number of innocent victims, and I have to say, including us in Birmingham and Warrington and Guildford and so on. Where they had been trying to get a meeting with Mr. Haass to identify what exactly how innocent victims and survivors of terrorism do to be punished so badly by terrorists, by government, and by wider society. Kenny Donaldson, who's one of the head leads of IVU, has made a comment saying, our group had been pursuing a meeting with Mr. Haas for 2 months, and belatedly a meeting was offered. We should never have had to go with the begging bowl, but we are where we are. It perhaps says something of the contempt with which our constituency of victims and survivors is held, because we refuse to give in to a juggernaut of opinion which seeks to sanitise the role of terrorism played in holding our country and people to ransom for over 40 years. Now, with reference to that, I've been saying all along that the irreverence of how we have been treated through the decades has been and continues to be palpable. Now the likes of Larkin has further insulted us, or the other families of the dead, or those who survived the most evil acts of terrorism on innocent victims. Larkin will have been instructed to put the statement out there by the hierarchy of the UK government. I don't care what the Prime Minister has said in PM.
Well, it seems to be that Larkin is speaking on his own.
This is a game. Politics is a game, all right? And what they do is they treat us all like bovine cattle. That they seem to think that their citizens are not worthy of their time or space. And because, as the old adage says, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If they really cared, then why have none of them, except for the likes of Andrew Mitchell, who did speak to us, and what he said he would do, he did do. Our own MP, Mr. Khalid Mahmood, has also put suggestions forward. We're still waiting to hear back from him, because we haven't heard from him for quite some months. Then why have we heard from nobody? And I have to say that Mr. Ivan Lewis's colleague, Yvette Cooper, who I've written to twice, has not had the courtesy to respond to any of these as the Shadow Home Secretary.
Brian,
I've written to her boss, and he hasn't responded either. It's absolutely right that they don't care about the likes of you and I. That they are just puppets. And I can tell you, Larkin is a puppet whose strings are being pulled by the hierarchy. And he was told to put that out there to see how it would be received.
Brian, if I could just speak to you for a second. If this is too painful, then tell me to move on. But I guess, can we get an element of the humanity into this? What was the situation? How did you find out about Maxine's, what happened to Maxine? And what was it like for your family?
I was watching the ITN programmes on the evening, and about 9 o'clock, there was an ITN news flash, which informed us that there has been two massive explosions in Birmingham city centre. that was the point of contact for me. But I did. You get these sixth sense feelings. I just knew, because I'd previously dropped her off in the city centre, that there was a probability that she was going to be involved.
And if you can try and describe it. What did it feel like? How did it affect you?
It was worse having to sit up all night in a chair waiting for my sister to come home, which, of course, she didn't.
And so when you hear something like this, Brian, from John Larkin, how does it make you feel?
I'm being polite. I am totally outraged. Clearly these people haven't lost people in circumstances, but I'm not making these comments as to wish that they had, or anyone that they know. If you lose a loved one, a sister, a mother, a daughter, you can't get to grips with it. And when comments are made that the armed struggle in Ireland is over, the reason why it is so raw with us every day is because the armed struggle continues to this very day. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the dissidents, whatever you might like to call them, as they keep rebranding themselves, tried to kill PSNI Chief Constable Matt Baggett. I mean, and what really aggravates me in the city that we live in, Birmingham, is that the West Midlands Police, they know who killed my sister. It was etched in stone 7 days from when they was all the so-called Birmingham Six was delivered to Queen's Road Police Station. You know, the guilty was proven to be innocent because of the unsafe inquiry, etc. And the West Midlands Police now, hierarchy, are complicit in carrying forward what has gone before, that being corruption, collusion, conspiracy, actions amounting to aiding and abetting. But now they use their infinite powers not to pursue the perpetrators, but to protect themselves. I mean, thank God we have people like the Commissioner Bob Jones and the head of the CTU, Kenny Bell, because hopefully one day these men will be put on the platform to lead and show the way, as opposed to the people that are there now.
Brian, Julie Hambleton, thank you very much indeed. The brother of 18-year-old Maxine Hambleton, who was killed along with all of those other victims so long ago. Thank you very much for that. 08453 009956. Well, earlier on, just before the show started, I spoke to Dr. Eamon O'Kane. He's a senior lecturer in politics and war studies at the Wolverhampton University, and also author of the forthcoming book, The Perpetual Peace Process, examining Northern Ireland's never-ending peace process. I asked him what he thought of these proposals.
Oh, it's incredibly controversial. And what's been very interesting is how poorly it's actually played across the board in Northern Ireland, from both communities, from most of the political representatives, and particularly from the victims groups and the families of those who would be most impacted if this was to be implemented. I mean, it really has played very badly.
What is the argument for this? Again, in inverted commas, amnesty. It's saying not to make any more prosecutions on events that took place before the Good Friday Agreement, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Right. What would be the reasoning behind that?
The reason behind it, and as you rightly suggest there, the word amnesty is problematic here, and the argument is that it isn't an amnesty. The rationale behind it being an amnesty, if you actually listen to John Larkin, who is the Attorney General that made the proposal, if you listen to his interview, what he argues is the reason he doesn't use the word amnesty, and would argue it's not an amnesty, is because in some variants of amnesty, what used to be a crime is no longer a crime, and that's not what he's proposing here. But the argument behind it, on that point, you know, the old adage that if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Mm.
Well, very few people would make the distinction between amnesty and non-amnesty if this was introduced. But the Attorney General's argument, at one level, is a practical one. And the reason that he's arguing this should come about is, as he acknowledges, very few people have actually been prosecuted for events before 1998 in recent years. There are some legal restrictions on, in certain cases, a type of forensic evidence that could be used and collated, and also the fact that anybody who is convicted of an event that took place, or a crime that took place before 1998, would serve a maximum of 2 years. And the argument here is, at one level, a very practical one, chances of prosecution are unlikely, and as each year goes on, become less likely. The cost of investigating the past is very expensive. There was a report just the other day that suggested, I think it's around $178 million over the next 5 years will be spent on policing the past. So at one level, what he's suggesting is a practical acknowledgement of a political reality that not many prosecutions are going to happen anyway, to draw a line under the past. That would be the argument behind it.
It's very cold, though, isn't it? I mean, I'm trying to imagine if I had lost a family member in a situation like that, that would really cut me.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the point I was making a moment ago is the rationale behind it. And what at one level, perhaps he's trying to do is make a sort of a general point, but it's a general point that just doesn't work in the cases, and most people, myself included, as it happens, would argue shouldn't work in the cases that we're talking about here. For victims groups, this is, as you say, very, very cold. I mean, abstractly, you can make the point about the difficulty of prosecution, the chances of success, the cost of doing this. But the reality is, if you're going to say that we're going to effectively draw a line under the past, and anybody who lost a loved one in the previous period, we feel terribly sorry for you, as he acknowledged in the interview, but that's where we are, let's move on. I mean, a very good point was made in an article this other day by Malachy O'Doherty, a journalist in Belfast, and he argues that, granted, they are not likely to be convicted now anyway, though some might, you say none should. And that's actually a very, very cold and very controversial thing to say. And what has been interesting is that so few people have embraced this, with very, very few exceptions. Across the political spectrum, everyone's come out and said he's speaking for himself, and some people, victims groups particularly, have been absolutely furious about it.
What's the likelihood of Larkin's suggestions actually becoming a reality?
Again, this is quite interesting. If you looked at his own criteria, because in the interview, what he actually says was, at the end, he says, the real test of the acceptability of these proposals is how well victims respond to them. Well, if that is the criteria, then this really has no legs whatsoever. The universal, I mean, what some people have said, it's opened an interesting debate. And in fairness to him, at one level, it's contribution to a debate that's going on. There's a very heated and difficult debate going on in Northern Ireland at the moment about how you do deal with the past. And as you probably know, there's the Haas talks going on. There's an investigation into just this issue with a report due out by Christmas. And Larkin himself has made a submission to it, so it might be related to this. But that's a much wider debate. In terms of the chances of it actually coming about, I'd be absolutely amazed if it goes any further.
And this will be resonating with people listening to this on BBC WM, because it is, of course, the anniversary of the bombs in 1974 that killed 21 people in Birmingham. So how do you think they'll be feeling when they hear this?
Oh, I mean, obviously, at one level, I wouldn't speak for these people because I'm not affected by this, but trying to put yourself in their position, and I'm sure they will be absolutely furious, as many victim groups have come out and said they're absolutely furious. You know, if you are listening over the last few days and reading the papers as somebody who lost a loved one or were yourself injured in these terrible bombings all those years ago, to somebody turn around and say, actually, what I'm proposing now is we draw a line, and even if we found out who did these terrible things, that would be the end of it, we won't take it any further. You know, you would rightly think, sorry, this isn't what I see of the role of the legal establishment in, you know, a liberal democratic state. The idea is there's not a statute of limitation in this regard on murder, and the idea has been that if we find somebody who did a terrible crime in the past, they are prosecuted for it. And that would stand, so I'm sure there's many people out there who are deeply concerned and very, very upset.
Eamon O'Kane, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you.
Cheers, Eamon. That was great. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. 08453-009956. Have your say on that. What do you think? And amnesty, it's slightly wrong, but it's a nice, easy shorthand for all atrocities committed before the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. It's what Northern Ireland Attorney General John Larkin wants. Roger's in Sutton. Morning, Roger.
Good morning, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. What do you think?
I think it's appalling what's been done. I mean, this type of thing goes on in third world countries where, you know, they don't do the investigation, and you've got corrupt MPs, police and magistrates, the whole lot. It goes on in India on a very high scale. Millions and thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people are killed. I mean, it's all to do with religion and politics, basically, and it goes back to the Crusader days. And also, more recently, it's sort of an arms race. The whole thing about this is it's the poor, innocent families that suffer. And also, what really annoys me, it's the hardcore foot soldiers who come from working class families who suffer and get killed. And the only people who are making the money out of all of this is the politicians. I mean, you just have to look at Mark Thatcher. The other thing is,
I'm not quite sure how Mark Thatcher links into to this.
He's got his family in South Africa, okay. And out of the arms deals he's made, $500 million.
Okay, well, let's not go to the next one. I want to focus on this. What's happening? Discussed in Northern Ireland? Do you not think, Roger? Do you not think if we want to achieve peace, at some point, opposing sides have to kind of shake hands and walk away from their arguments? So, is there some logic in what is being suggested here?
There is some logic in what's been suggested, but I mean, you know, this isn't a very long time ago when it happened, you know, and I know what you mean. I know what you're saying.
And
you
that's
do
the
need
thing,
to
isn't it? If it was a long time ago, perhaps we do. And I, you know, we've just spoken to a family that's been affected by this. So I'm just putting this out there. I'm not saying it's not necessarily what I believe, but perhaps we do have to say it was a long time ago. Let's move on. Otherwise, we won't have peace in Northern Ireland, will we?
You're 100% correct there. I mean, everybody has arguments in the family or whatever as well. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to compromise as well. I agree with you there. But I just wanted to say that it's very, very sad because it's the innocent families.
Yeah.
And it leaves a black mark on them. I mean, you know, if you've lost somebody in the family, it's a very, very difficult one.
It is, Roger, and it's something that I, you know, luckily I can't really speak on from a point of knowledge, which is why I thought it was important that we spoke to Brian and Julie earlier on, because they did, of course, lose their sister, and I think that it was important to get their view on this. You can give us a call on this. I'm here until 12 o'clock, and the way this works is we just keep talking about the stuff. So if you want to call in about the situation in Northern Ireland, 08453 009956. We were also speaking about the school, the Cannock School, the Little Green, Green Community School in Huntingdon, which sent out a letter to its parents saying basically their kids want to be going to look at a mosque and look at other religions. And if they didn't attend, it would result in a racial discrimination note remaining permanently on their file. 08453 009956. Phil's in Cannock. Morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ian. And thank you very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure, and it's a contractual obligation. What would you like to say about this, Phil?
Yeah, well, I have to obviously say that I think the headmistress obviously got it seriously wrong with this this compulsion business. I go back exactly, I'm 63, I go back to 1960. I was 10 years old, and our lovely, lovely lady RI instructor, or teacher rather, Gwen Padley, I do hope she's still around. She's going to be about 85 now, I think. But she said to us, now, children, we're talking about going to visit a synagogue in Birmingham next week. Now, you must ask your parents if they have any objection to this. Of course, there were no letters involved in those days at all. My parents didn't have any objection, but my father did say something funny. He said, ask the rabbi if he can play Come to the Cookhouse Door on that little ram's horn thing. He said that they can play all sorts of tunes on those. But I did actually ask when we went to the synagogue in Birmingham. It's a terrific, terrific day out for us kids, and I don't remember any of the children who were withheld by parents. I think one little girl was off sick, but that was it. So the whole 23 of us crowded into this lovely little synagogue, and I can't remember exactly where it was. I mean, my knowledge of Birmingham is pretty well, even though I'm a West Bromwich lad and now live in Cannock, I can't remember exactly where it was, but the poor rabbi, he's surrounded by all these kids, all asking interesting questions. Now, they did say, all you lads, if you'd like to put on these little caps, if you don't want to, it's all right, and they got out these little paper bags with a nice new little skull cap, and the lads wore those. I don't remember the girls having any head covering at all. But
and did you enjoy it? Do you think you learnt from it, Phil?
Well, I did. I've never been in a synagogue since. And he showed us a little cine film of a service that was going on, which would seem very interesting.
See, I've never been in a synagogue. All I know about what happens in a synagogue is what I've seen from the Neil Diamond film, The Jazz Singer. That's literally my only education on it. Phil, I think the synagogue you're talking about, I think it's next door to us here at the mailbox, BBC WM, where we're based.
It could well be.
Phil, listen, very quickly, because I want to move on. Just quickly, you are a gentleman of a certain generation. You are 63. That means 50 indeed. Years ago, you would have been 13.
I was actually 10 years old, okay. So obviously it's my mathematics, this was 1960.
Did you watch Doctor Who when it first started, and are you excited about Doctor Who tonight?
I am absolutely over the moon about Doctor Who tonight, but unfortunately I'm going to have to video it because I'm going to be out working, but I'm just going back very briefly, don't want to hold up your callers. I learned quite a lot from that, and late in later life I became a sign fitter, and I've done fitting work in mosques. I wore head covering, I took my boots off, and I observed the customs of that premises of
Phil,
that place.
Thank you very much. You'd learnt because you'd been there as a youngster. And it did worry me a little bit, that mum we spoke to about 45 minutes ago, didn't want her kids going to a mosque because the Islamis, her word, have sex at 9. At the age of 9, not that time of the evening. And I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? 08453 00956. More on Doctor Who later on. Before that, though, we really quantum leap here on this show in terms of topic, which is why I quite enjoy it. Redcoats, famous over the last 80 years for red jackets and all the smiles, knobbly knee contests and the like. Well, this week, Butlins came to Birmingham to search for the latest generation of holiday camp hosts, holding auditions at the Birmingham Hippodrome. So we thought it's a good chance to link a black country girl with dreams of earning that red coat to someone who used a season as a red coat to kickstart her career as an entertainer. On the line now is one of the audition hopefuls, Abby Southall from Bliston. She's 21, and someone who's been who started their career as a red coat in 1975 is Joanna Lee. Good morning to both of you.
Hiya.
Good morning.
Abby, we'll start with you. You're working in a bingo hall at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you think that kind of would have helped you in your audition?
Yeah, I definitely think it helped me, as I got to go on like a presenter course and stuff, so I got to learn how to speak to people properly and how to like entertain people, and it really helped me, as in how to speak properly and all that sort of stuff.
What did you have to do at the audition?
What did I have to do? There was different stages, so we started off by doing a few silly things to show that we could make a fool of ourselves and just be all silly. Then we had one-to-one interviews, and then it moved on to a dance section and movement section, and then we had to show off our talents.
Well, what are your talents?
Mine's dance.
Okay. Can you sing at all?
No.
But that's part of it, isn't it? You have to kind of do everything, so you have to be able to knock out a tune.
Yeah, well, I can sing in, like, a chorus.
Right,
but
okay.
I don't think they'd want to hear me sing solo,
Do you do that thing I used to do when I was in the choir at school? I would just mime. Do you do that?
Well, I'd sing, but I'd sing quietly.
Why do you want to be a red coat?
I love entertaining people. It's something I've always loved doing. Like, I've been a dance teacher. I really enjoy being around children. So it's something it helps me, and it's a perfect place to be for me, really.
And did they give you an indication of how well you did?
Well, because we had cuts throughout the day, at the end of the day, there was only a few of us left.
Oh.
So that was the indication that we'd done well for the day.
Did you make it to the end?
Yeah, we basically did the best out of our group in the day.
Yeah.
And then they said they'd phone us to tell us whether we'd get the job. And I actually got the phone call yesterday to tell me that I got the job.
Hey, fantastic. That's brilliant.
I know, I'm over the moon.
Oh, I bet you are. Well done. I didn't know that was coming. So when do you start? What happens now?
I start in January. I get sent all the information through now to tell me what's going to be happening. I start on January 13th, and that's when all the training starts.
Well, Abby, stay there, because listen to this, is Joanna Lee. Joanna, is this making you nostalgic for 1975?
Yes, it is a little bit. I have to confess, I didn't have to go through half of what Abby's been through as far as auditions are concerned. My audition was literally a one-to-one interview with Red Brigden, who is a well-known entertainment manager in the Butlin Group, in an office above Oxford Street, and literally a phone call a couple of days later to say I'd got the job.
And it's amazing, isn't it? Redcoats are just such an iconic image that has survived for so long. Why is that, do you think, Joanna?
I don't know. I think it's, I mean, for me, I used to go to Butlins as a child on the holiday, and, you know, children aspire and want to be redcoats. And, I mean, that was my drive for me wanting to do it. But it's just, you know, it's a childhood thing, isn't it? I mean, it's like all kids know Disney and all kids know Butlins. So I think it's famous for many, many reasons, you know, that being some of them.
And it must have been so exciting.
It was. It's funny now that I'm older and I look back and I think, gosh, you know, I wish I'd taken more pictures, or I wish I'd kept in touch with more people. I mean, it goes by so quickly. And when you look back, you realise what an absolute experience it was. It's just such a good thing to do.
Are you still in showbiz now, Joanna?
I've been a semi-professional singer for sort of over 30 years. And had it not been for Butlins, I'd never have been given the opportunity to get up on stage and have a go and, you know, fulfil what was a a small talent then. It wasn't until I went on the road as a singer that I learnt my craft. But the great thing about Butlins is it's an ideal environment for you to experiment and be given the opportunity to showcase your talents. And even though, Abby, you say you can't sing, you'd be surprised. Once you get in those red coat shows, you have to sort of muck in and get on with it.
Did you keep your red coat, Joanna?
No, you're not allowed to keep them. You have to hand them in at the end of the season.
Oh, I see. Any advice for Abby? She's about to start on a really exciting journey, and I didn't know she got the gig. That's wonderful news. What would you suggest to her?
My advice to Abby would be take some comfortable shoes, because you are on your feet an awful long time during the day. Don't be surprised by the long hours, because you're on duty from the time you leave your chalet in the mornings until the time you go to bed at night. And just enjoy every moment and take as many pictures as you can, because you will experience such a lot. And it all goes by in such a rush, so just make sure you capture the memories.
Abby, are you looking forward to it?
Oh, yeah, I'm so looking forward to it. Thank you for that advice. That was great advice.
Listen, it's lovely to talk to both of you. Thank you so much. That was Joanna Lee, who was a redcoat back in 1975, and Abby Southall, who got the gig. We didn't know that story was going to have such a happy ending. Well done. Fantastic. If you want to give us a call about your red coat memories or your holiday memories, 08453 009956. We will be talking about Doctor Who in the last hour. I'm getting the feeling the production team here, who aren't particularly excited about Doctor Who, are trying to make sure we don't squeeze it in. Oh, we'll be squeezing it in. The 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. I'm genuinely very not really been following Doctor Who the last couple of years. Didn't like Matt Smith. Too young. But I'm excited about tonight. Very excited. You can give us your calls on that. And also, after 11 o'clock, have you ever found a wallet full of cash or an envelope with some cash in or a purse or something like that? A fella walking his dog in Lincolnshire found a bag with 60 grand in, £60,000 in. Have you ever found some money on the floor? What did you do with it? Did you keep it? Or did you hand it in? And did you get a reward? 08453 009956. But back to this school that we've been talking about, Littledon Green Community School, that sent out a letter. The kids were going to go and look at different religions. The headmistress, Mrs. Small, sent out a letter saying it was compulsory. If the children didn't attend, it would result in a racial discrimination note remaining permanently on their file. 08453 009956. A few things here, aren't there, to be discussed, I think. It's pretty obvious Mrs. Small, the headmistress, was wrong to threaten parents. And to threaten the children with a racial discrimination note, that's not fair. But would any parent really object to their kids going to look at a place of worship that wasn't their faith? So, you know, going to a church or a synagogue or a mosque or a temple. I would be very surprised. We've had one caller already, one of the parents who goes to the school, who doesn't want her two children at the school to go to a mosque because she doesn't like Islamese, because they are disgusting, because they have sex at the age of 9 and because they have to do all these horrible things. I don't think they do have sex. Maybe I've missed something there. I don't think they do have sex at the age of 9. I don't think it's written that they have to. And isn't that part of the problem? By not sending our children to different places of worship, it's creating an air of fear, prejudice, a lack of knowledge. Knowledge is power, isn't it? And by not knowing about other people and other customs. And why do they wear those silly things in their head? And why do they kneel on those silly-looking mats? By not knowing the answer to those questions, that's ignorance and that's dangerous, isn't it? 08453 009956. Sally's in Small Heath. Morning, Sally.
Hiya.
Sally, what would you like to say?
I would just like to say that I've got four grandsons, and they go to different schools in and around Birmingham.
Yeah.
And I have to say that there are Muslim children in their schools, each of the four lads, and within their school, there are Muslim children who never, ever attend or take part actively in Christian celebrations. They don't sing Christmas carols, and this is a fact, I'm not making it up. They don't sing Christmas carols, they don't go to church, and I think if we are living in the Christian country, then I do think, I'm not racist in any way, but I do think that people actually have to take part in what we would term as British traditional celebrations. I think it's really important.
I don't go to church.
There are children. Sorry, you don't go to church.
I don't go to church.
But I think it's a Christian country, and I think before you said quite tongue-in-cheek that Christmas, you know, will never stop. But I think
Not tongue-in-cheek. Fact, Christmas will never stop in this country, Sally.
But the thing is, if there are more and more children who are actively not taking part, not learning the Christmas carol, not learning the Christmas message, then obviously Birmingham itself is becoming... You know, we are becoming a minority. White people are becoming a minority.
Are you genuinely afraid that Christmas will stop happening in Birmingham?
Afraid. No, let me... I don't want to hype this up.
No, but let me finish. Listen to the sentence. Are you afraid that Christmas will stop happening in Birmingham, in 15 years' time?
Well, we all know that there are some authorities who don't even want Christmas lights on. We know that for a fact.
Well, that's to save money. I do not believe...
some people have actually said it, haven't they? I know, you know, you're trying to be, you know... But what
I'm trying
saying
to be what?
That some authorities have actually said...
Trying to be what?
That they don't want...
Which authorities?
I don't know, but I can't tell you for a fact, because we all know that they're there.
We don't know. We don't know. You can't...
Why are you saying that?
Because you can't name them, and because I don't know for a fact.
I can't name them, but I know it.
How?
I know that there are.
How? Where are they? Where have you heard this?
Because you see in the paper. I don't sit there, because I'm not actively seeking for this information. I'm not actively thinking, it is a fact.
It's not a fact, Sally. You don't know where it's from.
There are some of them who will say they don't want it because it will offend certain minorities. We know that.
No, we don't, Sally. Sally, you keep saying we know that. We don't know. You don't. Tell me. Tell me.
We do.
Tell me where it is, then.
No,
you can't, because
it
doesn't actually happen. It's a myth.
No, I don't know where it is. But that's been reported.
But you're saying Islamic kids, Muslim kids should go to church because it's what we do in this country.
No, I'm not saying that they have to, but what I'm saying, we've got to remember that there are other groups who don't actively want to take part
Why don't we set the example?
Yeah, that's fine. I'm not saying that the parents are wrong, or right, to say they don't want their children to go. But what I'm saying is, it has to be an open debate. We have to recognise that it goes both ways.
It does go both ways, and no one's denying it. I'll put my cards on the table. I think those parents who don't want their kids to go to other places of worship, I think they are wrong. I think that's really, really sad, Sally, that they wouldn't want to do that.
Because I think it's wrong that Muslim children don't take part in these, like, Christmas songs. And I do actually think that schools should actually take the parents aside and say, you know, you have to, they should be encouraged to do it. I'm not saying they have to, but it certainly shouldn't be accepted as the norm. Okay, I'm Muslim, I don't want my child to take part in Christmas carols. Okay, that's fine. I don't think that's right. I don't think we should bend over to the extent that some schools seem to be doing. I think they have to give a valid reason as to why don't you want your child. You know, you have, remember, some of these families are newly arrived families.
Sally, thank you very much. Well, not many of them. Not many of them. Sally, thank you very much. I do think it's sad if you don't want your kids to go to another place of worship. I think it's sad, okay? I have to get off the fence. I'm getting splinters. I think it's a little bit sad. And okay, we can expand this. Is it a Christian country anymore? I know it has been. One of the archbishops in the week was saying that Christianity will be dead in a generation in this year, in this country. Is it a Christian country? And is there anything wrong with your kids going to look at other places of worship? I think it's sad that we don't want to educate them. And if so, and by the way, I'm happy to be corrected. If someone can phone up and tell me a local council anywhere in this country that has banned Christmas because it will offend the Muslims, if you can phone up and tell me, 08453 00956, then I will apologise. I don't think it happens. I think it's a myth. Teresa's in Lichfield. Morning, Teresa.
Good morning. This debate is getting worse by the minute, isn't it? Or more complicated.
It's tricky.
And I'm sure there is no one that's banned Christmas.
Don't think it has been banned. I think it's one of those myths.
I'm sure not. Now, I initially, when I heard it, I was incensed.
And then as I listened, I thought, you know, at the end of the day, this lady's made a mistake.
This is the headmistress, Mrs. Small.
Yeah, she's made a mistake. And it's probably insensitive to people. You had an earlier caller, Marlene, and if you tell me I can't do something, and then you, not threaten, but, you know, imply that my child's going to have that, it's a form of bullying, is it not?
Yeah.
And then also...
Marlene was good, because Marlene was the lady that had the feisty switch, that if someone says you can't do something...
That, you know, you don't tell me.
Me too.
Excuse me, and my child, excuse me. But then equally, one of my points is that the fact is, in the early 60s, I went to a Methodist church and I asked to go to Sunday school. And I happily went every Sunday and I loved it. It wasn't until years later I actually noticed that myself and my friend are the only white girls there. It never occurred to me at the time. And by sending a letter home, and let's face it, the mother or the father's going to open the letter and then say they've said this, it's almost inciting racism, in my opinion.
Well, it is. It's getting people's backs up, isn't it?
What's the big deal?
But not everyone thinks we're the same. And we are. I'm so surprised that anybody has called in to say they would object to their children or their grandchildren going to a mosque or to a temple. I can't understand why people would be so closed-minded.
No, because my daughter had, you know, religious studies and they just explored all religions.
Mm.
But having said that, you know, listening to the lady before on that, and I'm thinking, you know, oh, well, ban Christmas. It doesn't happen. However, it did put a little thought in my mind, because when I was at school, the Jehovah's Witnesses did not attend a morning assembly, because it was religious.
Yep.
And fair enough. So, you know, if we're going to embrace all religions and all faiths, surely knowledge is the most important thing, as you say.
Teresa, thank you very much indeed. I don't think Christmas has ever been banned anywhere. Prove me wrong. 08453 009956. Just cutting you short there, Teresa, because I wanted to squeeze Valerie in before the news at 11. Valerie, you've got about a minute. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on what Sally was saying regarding about some authorities would like to actually diminish Christmas if they could. I remember a few years back, I think I'm going about 5 years, where Birmingham City Council was trying to call it not Christmas, but Wonderland or Winterland or something like that, and I actually got totally offended, and I phoned up Birmingham City Council and I told them how dare them think that they can diminish Christ out of Christmas. They soon backtracked because it's not on, and she is right, this is a Christian country.
Is it still though, Valerie? Christianity is diminishing hugely, church attendances are falling.
Yeah, that's fair enough, but if you went to a Muslim country or an Islamic country, you would have to follow their religion.
Valerie,
or you would have to keep...
not true. I'm sorry to cut you short, that's not true at all. As I say, I spent 3 months in Pakistan and people were quite happy. There were churches there, Christian churches, people could go and pray. So not quite true, Valerie, but thank you very much. Sorry to cut you short. 08453 009956. Coming up, more of your talk on religion, on schools, on Dominic Grieve, on Doctor Who. Yes, Doctor Who. Very, very... and an artist who makes art out of coffee. Really? Is he just some chancer who's trying to get some deal with Nespresso? We'll find out in a bit. 08453 009956.
Ian Lee, Saturdays.
9 till 12. BBC WM.
95.6.
Morning, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Nick here until 12 o'clock. And then Daz takes over talking about football and stuff, probably. Football. Lots to talk about. We're carrying on the talks about, would you mind if your children or your grandchildren went to visit a religious place of worship that wasn't their own religion, a church, a mosque, a temple, a synagogue? Turns out lots of you would. I'd suggest that's a little bit narrow-minded. We're also talking about Doctor Who a little bit later on. Oh, there's all kinds of stuff. But in this hour, if you find a load of cash on the floor or in the back of a taxi or in a bus, what would you do with it? 08453 009956.
Have your say.
Across the West Midlands, call 08453 009956.
BBC WM 95.6.
That's the last hour. It's kind of like the last day of the week. My weekend starts in 55 minutes, which is very, very exciting. So here's a dilemma. It may have happened to you at some point. It's happened to me. And I did, well, I did the right thing, I think. A couple of scenarios, okay? So scenario number one, you're a cleaner, you're working for an airline, and while you're undertaking the not-so-glamorous job of cleaning a toilet, you find hidden behind the loo a load of gold bars. 24 gold bars worth more than £600,000. What do you do? Well, I think with gold bars, you would have to hand them in, wouldn't you? Because they're going to be hard to get rid of. But what I would do with the gold bars, I would put them in my pockets to see what it felt like. I would. I'd fill my pockets up with gold bars and walk around a bit just to see what it felt like. 08453 009956. Scenario number two. Okay, this is more likely to happen to you. You're out. You're walking your dog through the park or along the local river when you spot a bag of banknotes floating along the water. And you look at it and it's about £60,000 worth. Would you take it and run? Would you take some of it and hand some of it in? Or would you hand all of it in? 08453 009956. Both of these scenarios happened in real life, not the person running around an aeroplane with gold in their pockets. They all happened last month. A cleaner for Jet Airways in India discovered the gold bars on Tuesday and reported it to the airline. Police believe it was part of a smuggling ring. And at the end of October, a man walking his dog in Lincolnshire handed a bag with... It was about 60 grand worth of cash into the local police. What would you do? And if this has ever happened to you, 08453 009956, what would you do? And if you ever lost something, money, laptop, purse, wallet, bag full of stuff, did you get it back? Was there some kind soul? I never forget, years ago, probably about 20 years ago, I found this guy's wallet. About 60 quid in it. There were credit cards, bank cards and things like that. His bank card was there and it had his name. And I phoned up his bank. It was Barclays. I phoned up his bank. I said, I found Mr. Smith's wallet. There's a few quid in it. This is my address. If he wants to come and collect it, he can come and collect it. He came and collected it. The next day, he phoned up and he said, that's fantastic. Thank you. I'd come and collect it. 60 quid, bank card, driving licence, load of stuff in there. He gave me £1. He gave me a pound, and you shouldn't expect a reward. Of course you shouldn't. But I expected a bigger reward than a quid. Yeah, I know. I was a little bit... 08453 009956. I'm joined now by Professor Craig Jackson, Head of Psychology at Birmingham City University. Craig, I like to think that people generally are good and would do the right thing. Am I right in thinking that?
Hello. I think lots of social psychology experiments where psychologists have used stooges or actors to recreate scenarios that test the moral compass of the public actually do find that on the whole people are good.
There are a battle of emotions, though, aren't there? When you if you're having a bit of tough luck and you're struggling to pay the rent and then you find a wallet with a couple of hundred quid in it, what's going on in the brain, Craig?
Well, absolutely. You said it there yourself. The first thing I think most people tend to do is they reflect on their own personal circumstances. If you're having a tough time and you're struggling to pay the rent or pay the bills, then that is going to be an added factor that most people might computate about, think about, even for a split second before we hopefully do the right thing. Some people, of course, say, I don't think about it. It's just instinct to do the right thing.
Mm.
But I think it's only human nature that we think about how much do we need and how much is there. So finding £5, as indeed I did the other day, is a lot different from finding £60,000. And we reflect on our own needs, how much do we think the owner could spare, and then we think about other things, other factors subconsciously come into play, such as a sense of entitlement. Such as where do we actually think we're lucky people? We view ourselves as being lucky or unlucky. And we sometimes think, well, do I deserve this? Do I actually deserve this? Has this happened for a reason? So lots of these factors go through our brain in a split second when we try to decide what we should do.
When you found the fiver, was it just a loose fiver on the street?
It was in the building where I live, and there was no way of knowing who it could belong to.
So, like most people, it's just a fiver. I put it on the side and thought, well, either the owner will come back and find it, or someone who needs it will benefit from it as well.
Hang on a second. You say, like most people, you put it on the side. Like most people, I would have thought, oh, there's a fiver. There's no evidence of who it belongs to. It's not obviously fallen out of someone's back pocket. I'll have that. But yet you put it on the side.
Well, I was always raised that if it doesn't belong to you and you find it, the owner will come back, whether it's a fiver or a glove or a woolly hat or a scarf. And let's not forget, related to the two stories you mentioned earlier on, we do live in an age where people are forensically aware. We live in a closed-circuit television society, and we live in a world of marked banknotes. And I think many people also would wonder, would my act of taking the money be captured somewhere on camera? So I think there's that element of knowing that somebody somewhere will know if you've been less than honest.
I expected a reward, Craig, when I was younger, and I found, I think I would still expect a reward. Is that human nature?
To expect a reward, I think it's human nature to expect something back, whether it's a thank you or appreciation or a letter or a little bit of something of value. I think that's only human nature. And it's also, of course, human nature to be disappointed when we get something less than what we were hoping for. Mm. So I don't think you should beat yourself up about feeling disappointed that you only got a quid. It was £1 more than you'd had earlier.
Yes.
You know, £1 more than you deserved, you could say. It's all to do with whether, I guess, what people take away from these scenarios. Do they feel cheated and swindled? And do they think, well, next time I'll be keeping that wallet? Or do you think, well, you know, easy come, easy go, and hopefully I'll do the right thing next time too. So it's also not so much about the reward we get in monetary terms, but the reward we get psychologically.
Craig, thank you very much indeed. Fascinating. It's Professor Craig Jackson, Head of Psychology at Birmingham City University. I am surprised when he said he put the fiver on the side. What's the cut-off point? Is it the amount of money, or is it whether there's any identification? If it's a wallet and it's got names in it, you have to give it in, don't you? A fiver on the floor, that goes in the pocket, doesn't it? That buys you a copy of Mojo magazine, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I think it does. 08453 009956. Tom's in Chelmsley Wood. Tom, what happened to you?
Oh, no. Yes, I went to, I don't know if you know the toilets by the post office in Solihull. They used to be manned at one time, and they're quite old toilets. But I went down there, and all around the toilet, there's a big shelf, and there was a bag there. It looked in the wrong place to me, so I had a look inside. And I couldn't believe what was in there, because there was just under, I did count it, there was just under £1,000 in cash.
Oh, hello, hello.
But not only that, there was a building society book with £5,000 in.
Oh.
There was post office books for him and his partner.
Yeah.
There was prescriptions, and I suddenly realised that I was holding this fella's life in his carrier bag.
Yeah.
He was carrying everything around that he needed.
Wow.
And I went and found my wife and said, and showed her what I'd found. And so we went round to his house. She only lived just outside Solihull. Anyway, we sat there for a while, and this old fella came, drove up with him and his, it may have been his sister. Anyway, I asked him if he'd lost anything. And he says, no. I said, are you sure? He said, why is someone falling off my car? And I thought, oh, dear, anyway, I went into his house with him, and I got this bag of money. I said, look, you've got everything here that you shouldn't be carrying on you. Your building society books, your post office payment books, they should all be put away. And all you should be walking around with is just a few bob in your pocket for whatever you've got to do.
Mm.
And he just put the bag on the back of the chair in the kitchen. And I was that concerned about it. I went back the next day to have another chat to him. And the bag was still there on the back of the seat, on the back of the chair. And it was then that he counted his house, and I said that there was just under £1,000.
Wow.
And but in the wrong hands, I mean, I suppose there's ways of doing it, but in the wrong hands, if somebody found the the money plus a building society book is £5,000 plus a post office books. I'm going back a few years.
Yeah.
But everything was there. He tried to put the blame on his partner.
There you go. You see, yes, you're right. In the wrong hands, £1,000. Bank, building society book, post office book, and some prescriptions. Oh, that's a lost weekend, isn't it? Tom, thank you very much indeed. 08453 00956. Marie, Joan, stay there. We will get to Doctor Who in a bit. We're going to speak to someone. Oh, I spoke to them earlier. Someone very, very exciting who created, well, was responsible for a huge, iconic moment in Doctor Who. We'll find out who it is and what it was a little bit later on. But right now I'm asking, what would you do if you found a wallet or a purse or some money on the floor? It reminds me, I was in Sweden about 3 or 4 years ago with my in-laws. They live out there. And I lost my wallet in Sweden, and it was full of foreign money, and it didn't have my passport. It had pretty much everything else. I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. Oh, no. And about 2 hours later, I got an email from someone saying, hello, are you in Sweden? I replied back, yes. We found your wallet. Do you want it? Yes. And basically, they'd gone through it. They were very clever. They'd gone through it. They'd kind of seen my name. They'd Googled it. They'd worked out that I, you know, occasionally pop up on TV and do stuff like this. And they found out my email. And they sent me an email. They were about 20 minutes away. So we went round to their apartment. And it was a bit weird. There was a weird vibe going on, okay? And I gave them a reward of probably, I think I probably gave them about 10 or 15 quid. It was in Swedish money, so I don't know what it was. But then, I think they were swingers. No, I do. It was very, very odd vibe there. And because I'm in broadcasting, I think they thought I was, you know, a bit more open-minded than perhaps I am. And they were saying, well, yeah, we're going to go to a club. Do you want to come to a club with us? I'm not a club person at all. I said, well, they said, it's a really interesting club. I think you like it. Why? Hey, just, you know, people, things happen there. I said, do you know what? I'm all right. Thanks. Bye. I was out of there. I don't want to go to a club where things happen. No way. 08453 00956. Joan has been waiting for a long time. Morning, Joan.
Morning.
Joan in Colton, what happened to you?
Well, it wasn't me. It was my husband.
Go on.
Well, yeah, he found a wallet and he looked in it and there was credit cards and various other cards in there. So he took it to the police. Get to the police. The police return it to the owner. Not a thank you, not anything. But the owner turned round at the police station and said, well, where's the money? And he accused my husband of taking the money that had been there as well. And he had an awful time, proving that he hadn't taken the money. So he said, if ever he sees a wallet on the floor now, it'll stay where it is.
Oh, dear. So, Joan, I have to ask the question, did he take the money?
No,
he didn't.
No.
Okay, good. He didn't take the money.
No,
oh, how cheeky!
No, he found it in the course of his job. You know, he was doing the job. He was looking after a retail park, and he just happened to look on the floor, and somebody must have just thrown it there, and he took it in.
And so, did he have to go and explain to the police that he hadn't taken the money?
Yeah.
Oh,
well, he was
dear.
At the police. And he said, I tell you what, he says to me, he says, it'll stay, if ever I see another one, it'll stay there and somebody else can pick it up.
Joan, thank you isn't that sad? I think you have to expect, if you lose your wallet, if you're ever going to get it back, just assume it will be sans cash. There will be no money in there. I think you have to, don't you? And if the money is in there, or a percentage of the money is in there, that's a bonus. 08453 00956. Has it happened to you? Have you lost something? Have you found something? What happened? Marie, in Cosley. Marie, what's your story?
Oh, it's going back to the 80s, so it's quite a while ago. But the week before Christmas, I went into a public toilet. I followed a girl in very similar circumstances to me, with kids in a pushchair and toddlers. And after we'd finished, on the toilet, back of the toilet, there was a purse.
Mm.
So I knew it was hers. So I opened it. It must have been about £80, which now doesn't sound a lot, but in those days it would have been a lot of money.
80 quid still sounds a lot to me right now, I tell
you. Yeah.
I could do
in
with that.
In the 80s, yes. That would be like 300 quid or something like that. So then I was debating what I thought. Oh, it was freezing cold. I thought, I'm going to have to take it to the police station. But I knew it was this girl's. But as I walked out,
she come flying back up the high street with her kids. So I knew it was hers, and I just said, "Here's your purse." I think she was that shocked, she just grabbed it off me and ran off.
Oh, cheeky mare! Did she not say thank you or anything?
No, nothing.
Oh.
I think she was so sort of shocked that she'd got it back. The ironic thing is, the week before, I'd cashed in my 2 weeks' family allowance, dropped it or lost it on the way home with my book and everything in a little wallet, and never got it back.
Oh, dear.
It made me feel better.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's the thing. I've been talking about rewards, and really, in the great cosmic spiritual scheme of things, it is. It's a nice feeling to return something to someone, isn't it?
It was, even though she'd just sort of shot off. I think she was that shocked that she'd got it back.
Yeah,
and I knew it was hers anyway because she'd been in before me. But just on a different note, you're talking about Doctor Who.
Yes. Oh,
later
yes.
Later on,
yes,
save
yes.
me phoning you later.
Yeah, go on.
Oh, Doctor Who is nothing. I'd love somebody to ring in to the horrific memories I've got of a children's programme in the 60s,
yeah,
which knocks Doctor Who into a cocked hat.
Go on, tell me what it is.
It's called The Singing Ringing Tree.
The Singing Ringing Tree? The
Singing Ringing Tree.
What on earth is that?
It was a Czechoslovakian or Polish subtitled programme in black and white. It was like Grimm's fairy tales that had real dwarfs in it. That's not politically correct, I know. Oh, horrific. It was nightmarish. And I'd love somebody to ring in just to say that I haven't imagined it. It was horrible.
I'm trying to Google it.
Google it.
And I can't find... Oh, hang on a minute. The Singing Ringing Tree. Let's have a little look. It's German.
Yeah. Oh, was it German? It says
here, it was a children's film made by East German Studios. The story concerns a beautiful but selfish princess...
That's it.
...who rejects the proposal of a wealthy prince.
Yes.
She'll only marry him if he brings the mystical singing ringing tree.
Yes, it was horrible but compulsive viewing.
Oh, you don't get... This is what you don't get with kids' shows anymore. Things like Doctor Who, things like this... It sounds hideous, the singing ringing tree. You don't get things that scare kids anymore. And that's all part of growing up, is that fear of watching something that's quite scary.
Oh, you watched it behind a cushion. It was horrible, but compulsive.
Marie, now be honest with me. Are you excited about Doctor Who tonight? Are you going to be watching it?
No.
Oh!
No, I won't be watching. No, it's
tape
not
it.
The same. No, it's not the same as the Cybermen and the Daleks. No,
it's not the same. But allow that 13-year-old Marie that's still trapped within you, allow her to be tickled pink by Doctor Who and all the nods to the previous Doctors.
No.
Right, in that case, Marie, I'm sending the Singing Ringing Tree round to you. Get it on DVD, send it to that woman's house. Marie, thank you very much indeed. 08453 009956. We will be talking Doctor Who in a bit. You can call in about it now if you want. I spoke to someone before the show, you'll hear it in a bit. Very, very exciting. He played a pivotal role in Doctor Who. Before that, though, Chloe's in Hales Owen. Morning, Chloe.
Hi, morning.
What happened to you?
Oh, it's a few years ago now. I'd been to the bank to withdraw some money out to pay for my little girl's nursery fee, so I'd drawn out about £280, put it in my purse, in my bag, and gone round to my friend's house, and we had a few glasses of wine, and drunkenly on the way home, I left my purse in the back of the taxi.
Uh-oh.
I only realised the morning after, and it's like, oh no, I'm never going to see that again. You know, either the taxi driver's had it, or his next fare is going to get in and just pocket my purse.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, I drew all my money out, so I didn't know what I was going to do. And then later on that evening, knock at the door, and there's the taxi driver with my purse, with all the money in it.
Wow.
I mean, what I was really worried about was the pictures of my children and my partner.
Yeah.
Everything was there. I was so grateful, and I just didn't expect it. So, I gave him £20, and I wish I could have given him more, to be honest. But things were tight then, and at the end of the day, I wouldn't have got that money back anyway, so I was so grateful.
And I think that's the thing. You wouldn't have got that money back. So £20, when you'd written it all off, it is nothing. And what a nice man.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it, to be honest. You know, it restored my faith in humanity when he locked my door that night, because things were tough for us then, and I didn't know how I was going to pay for the nursery fee. So, like I say, I wish I could have given him more, and I would have done if I'd got more. But I was really grateful, and I've used him ever since as well. So.
Well, there you go, Chloe. That's what you've done. Thank you for that. What a great story. 08453 00956. Now, indulge me. Let's have a moment to take a trip in time.
The Doctor must die.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Tonight, happy 50th birthday, Doctor Who. Very, very quickly, my two Doctor Who stories. My dad used to work at the BBC, Television Centre, in the props department. And one day, when I was about five, I've got a picture of this. I've got to dig this picture out. We lived on this council estate in Slough, and we had lock-up garages around the corner. He said, right, you and your sister, come to the lock-up garage. Oh, Dad, I don't want to be rubbish tools in. Come to the garage, I've got something to show you. Oh, all right. And we stood by the front of the garage. He said, right, now, don't be scared about what I'm about to show you. I'm thinking, what on earth has he got in there? He whipped open the garage door. There was a Dalek in there! A real, genuine Dalek! And my sister and I were terrified. And then we spent the rest of the afternoon sat in the Dalek with my dad pushing us around this council estate in Slough. I've got such a good picture, I must try and find it. Wonderful. My other Doctor Who story, again, we used to go and hang out at the BBC a lot. 5, 6 years old. It was five. It was 1978, and we're in the BBC, just hanging out with Dad. And suddenly, this guy walks past, and my dad says, "Have a look who that is." It was Tom Baker in full Doctor Who regalia: the hat, the coat, the scarf. And he said, "Go, it's Doctor Who, go and say hello to him." I said, "I can't." He said, "My dad went, oi, Doctor Who." My dad went, "Oi, Doctor Who, come over here." And Tom Baker came over and went, "Yes." So this is my boy, he's a big fan. "Hello, what's your name?" Talks like that. I said, "My name's Ian. Do you like watching Doctor Who?" I said, "Yes." "Do you get scared?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "So do I. I don't have any jelly babies. Have some sugar." He gave me two lumps of sugar and he walked off. It was the coolest moment of my life. Well, Doctor Who is 50 years old today. There's a bigger event happening at the NEC as well. The birthday is being celebrated with a memorabilia exhibition. Now, I got to have a word earlier with one Doctor Who great who's going to be heading to Birmingham this morning, scriptwriter Bob Baker. He wrote many Doctor Who scripts. He also created one of the Doctor's greatest sidekicks, K-9. When I asked him how he got involved in the writing of the show.
Yeah, well, I was writing with a partner, Dave Martin, throughout the 70s, and every year we wrote a story. We did 9 altogether for Doctor Who, and we created the dog, K-9.
You created K-9. Can I just say thank you? For the 13-year-old me, thank you very much indeed. I loved K-9. How did you come up with that?
Well, we were discussing a character in the story with the Invisible Enemy, and we sort of give him a little bit of depth, you know, and we thought, well, on Earth he may have been a dog lover, and of course he couldn't take one into space, so he made his computer into a dog shape and gave it certain qualities of dogginess.
And when you created K-9, was it just for that story, or was there kind of a brief that he might last a little bit longer?
No, we were totally surprised when they said we'd like to keep him on as a companion, and delighted, of course.
I bet he was a nightmare to operate, though, wasn't he?
Well, apparently in the early days, before they got into technology at the BBC, there are rumours that he kept knocking the scenery down, but I'm not sure I believe every one of them. But now, I do believe that the electronics interfered with some of the cameras or something.
Now, dear listener, just indulge me 2 minutes of pure geekiness. I remember that, the Invisible Enemy, because I was 5 years, 6 years old then when I was watching that. Was that the one where Doctor Who goes into his own brain?
That's the one.
Bob, you're mental. How did you come up with that stuff? Because that freaked me out. He goes into his own brain.
Yes, well, I mean, if you're in the kind of weird Doctor Who world, things like that can happen.
Yep. You must have had so much fun writing those stories.
Oh, we did. We were laughing all the way.
And were you a science fiction writer? Was that your background?
No. I always enjoyed science fiction, and I'd watched The Doctor ever since it started, you know, the very beginning. And I was fascinated by it, and this was long before I became a writer, obviously. But I suddenly found myself writing, and then we got commissioned to do a Doctor Who, and I thought, wow, this is fantastic.
Now, you are in some ways, I know you're not directly responsible for the 50th anniversary, but you kind of have set the trend. Am I right that you wrote The Three Doctors, which is where William Hartnell, John Pertwee and Patrick Troughton got together?
Yes, we had the honour of doing the 10th anniversary, yes.
So you kind of set the precedent for old Doctors meeting up with current Doctors, didn't
you? Yes, yes. It was a bit daunting to begin with, but once we got used to it, unfortunately, poor old William Hartnell couldn't do the whole of his dialogue, because we did a lot more for him, of course, but he was ill, so they just filmed him in the glass bubble, as it were. But we had some great exchanges between the sort of same people. You know?
Oh, it's very... Well, I've become a dandy, I seem to remember. But why do you think Doctor Who has survived so long? 50 years is an incredible amount of time for any series.
It never ceases to amaze me, but there is something, a quality about it, which, people didn't see at first. I mean, I watched the first episode last night, or night before, and I thought, my goodness, this is drama. You know, really is drama. It's meant for children, but it had fantastic actors in it, playing smaller parts, and the stories were good. I think that's the thing. If you get the stories good, and then you've got the added thing of the time and relative dimensions in space, it just gives it a kind of twist, which a lot of other programmes don't get.
And I was a Tom Baker fan, and I was lucky enough to have met Tom when I was 6 years old. He was dressed up as Doctor Who. It was one of the most amazing moments in my life. And I think people kind of laugh if they look at those old episodes, because the sets are a bit wobbly, and maybe the monsters aren't that convincing. But, as you say, Bob, it's the stories. Those stories still stand up, don't they?
Absolutely. Don't forget what Hitchcock says, the best, the most important thing in a film is a good script and a good script.
Mm.
And I think they kept that sort of banner flying all the way through. I mean, when we did it in the 70s, we had Terrence Dicks and various other people script editing, and we just weren't happy unless we got it absolutely right. And it was a really quite arduous thing writing a Doctor Who, because you always picked up on things, you know, and you know, made sure you know what you're talking about. That's the important thing. If you do the science bit, you've got to know what you're talking about.
Who's the best Doctor Who? I want a name. I don't want any fudging here, Bob. Who was it?
Tom Baker.
Yay! Well done. That's the correct answer. 5 points. And finally, will you be watching the 50th anniversary tonight?
Yes, I will, from afar.
How do you think that's going to... Is it going to be emotional, do you think?
I don't know. I'll try not to make it emotional. I'll try not to cry, but I'll have a hanky.
Yes, I think I'm going to be... I'm asking all of the listeners today, however cynical, embrace and entertain that inner child tonight. Let that 12-year-old boy come out tonight and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Bob, listen, thank you so much, A, for coming on the show this morning, and B, for all of the work you did for my childhood in the 70s. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
What a nice man. Can I just say, in the last 2 days, my 13-year-old me has been so excited. Spoken to him. I spoke to the fella yesterday who invented the sound of the TARDIS. I know, incredible. 08453 00956. Give me a call with your Doctor Who memories. Or, even if you hate Doctor Who, phone up and I'll try and sell it to you. Lee's in Solihull. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
Lee, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I'm a window cleaner, I used to clean his windows. But he tried to rip me off the window, he tried to get me to do the inside of the TARDIS the same price as the outside.
Lee, thank you very much. Go on, jog on, fella. What a... dearie me. Lee was all excited there, thank you for that. It wasn't that bad. Mo's in Tamworth, let's go to you, Mo, first. Hello, Mo.
Hello, Ian.
You looking forward to Doctor Who?
No, I hate it.
Sorry? Why?
I don't hate it, because I don't watch it, and I never have. Well, I've seen bits and bobs. But what I object to it at the moment is that it's everywhere. It's been thrown in our faces, and, you know, you don't know which way to turn to get away from it. And I was quite surprised at you. It is a male thing, Ian.
Oh, no.
It's true.
Have you seen any of it?
Well, over the years, I've seen bits and bobs, yes.
Yeah. He's got a time machine that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, am I supposed to be impressed?
Yes, you are. Mo, stay there. I want you to talk to Chris, because, Chris, you are a big Doctor Who fan, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When you hear people like Mo... When you hear people like Mo whinging on, how does it make you feel?
I think a lot of it
is back down to the 80s because the imagination was there, but the technology wasn't. And I think a lot of people think about the clunky sets, etc. And nowadays, you've got the technology to kind of, like, fit the scripts. They've stripped down on all the chases and stuff like that. Everything's tight and concise, and you've got a story in 40, 50 minutes. And also nowadays, you've got more credible actors bringing a lot to the part. There's a lot of history that goes with it. And did you see An Adventure in Time and Space on Thursday night?
I missed it. This was the drama,
you
wasn't it? About
something,
yeah.
Because what you can do now, and I think this is something that is really tempting, the cast of that show, who played the original four, if they could now do some of the old scripts as one-off specials. And then you've got Reese Smith playing the second Doctor. That could be done as a special.
Hang on a second, Mo. What were you saying, Mo?
I'm falling to sleep. I'm bored out of my mind. Can I leave the room?
No, you cannot, Mo. You have to. The door is locked. No one goes until I say so. Chris is making it sound exciting and thrilling, isn't he?
The thing is, you've got
He's making the programme sound as boring as I always thought it was.
The thing is now, it's for a new generation of people. I think, like, there's a certain generation...
A new generation of men.
No, you have to see it nowadays. I mean, like, a lot of Doctor Who nowadays is taken from the companion's point of view. And the companion...
Well, isn't it on the same time as Strictly?
It's on before Strictly.
Chris,
at least it is on a Saturday.
Chris, I don't think that we're selling it to Mo. Maybe, and this isn't a criticism because I'm on your side, but maybe you're making it sound a little bit too geeky and a bit too blokey. Try and sell the feminine aspect to Mo.
Oh, that'd be good.
I think the feminine aspect is that, like, it is. I mean, like, nowadays, it is kind of like something for the ladies. I mean, like, why can't women go out into space? I mean, like, they can go up onto the Skylab. I mean, like, one of the parallels that they did on Thursday was the first woman in space. And, like, it was kind of like, yeah, it can be done. If a woman can go into space, why can't a woman produce a TV show?
Listen, there's a queue as long as your arm, or longer, as long as a mile, for men wanting to go into space. I bet there isn't a queue as long as a metre for women wanting to go into space, because we, the more intelligent sex, are more interested in the Earth.
I don't think that there's a lot of things that, like, are earthbound that, like, women are achieving in, and I mean, like... You know, I mean, like, television production. I mean, like, if you see a lot of the production and the cast now that are doing Doctor Who, you look down that cast list and see how many are women.
Mo, I'm picking up the idea that you're not going to watch it whatever we say to you.
Absolutely right.
That's a real shame. You're missing out on what's going to be a wonderful... Would you do me a favour, Mo?
Yeah, okay.
Would you watch a bit of it tonight? And if I'm back next week, if Nick is still poorly and I'm back next week, give me a call and let me know how you got on.
OK, I like that challenge, Ian, I will do that. So I'll look forward to hopefully being back on next week.
Mo, thank you very much indeed. Chris, thank you very much as well. 08 453 00 9956 is the telephone number. Now, tours of the world, Christmas at Sandringham and waving from the palace balcony. Who wouldn't want to be a member of the royal family? Me? Sophie Wessex pushed past me the other day. Is that her name? I think that's her name. Sophie Wessex, married, the one married to Edward, pushed past me. Well, you may have seen the photographs recently of Prince Harry with his girlfriend. Is this her name? Cressida Bonus. Is that her name? Well, her older brother, Jacoby. These aren't real names, are they? Her older brother, Jacoby, has reportedly spoken out this week about his concern for her if she ever married the prince and became a royal. So I'm asking this morning, would you ever want your son or your daughter or your grandchildren to marry a royal? Well, I'm joined now by Jordan Lee Squibb, who is the deputy editor of royalcentral.co.uk. It must be difficult, Jordan, for commoners to become part of the royal family PLC.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, it's definitely a difficult position. I mean, I think for anyone, you know, whatever family you come from, it's a difficult position. We only need to look back at Diana. You know, that was a a really, you know, strange atmosphere for her to be thrown into, and she commented that she was felt very lonely and isolated. And, you know, it comes with great privilege, but you're under the level of scrutiny that you come under, you know, is so extreme that I think it's hard for anyone.
It's hard, isn't it? It must be hard for Catherine, but, you know, because I know she's quite posh. She's still termed as a commoner. And also the effect it has on the rest of her family. I mean, Pippa, for example, has they've gone a bit quiet on her recently, but she was a bit of a press target for a while, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, Pippa is in a very difficult position because she's not a royal, and she doesn't get any help from the royal family or, you know, money or anything like that. So she has to carve out her own career. But she's kind of damned if she does and damned if she does. You know, she released a book, and that come under, you know, huge criticism. And she wasn't really able to promote it because if she was, obviously all the questions would be about Catherine and not really about the book. So she was quite in a difficult one. But yeah, it does really, you know, reflect on your family. And I think, I mean, the Middletons have done really well. And, you know, there's been no scandal or no, you know, criticism towards them. They've kind of kept out of the public eye.
What do we know about Cressida Bonas? Is that her name?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know too much about it at the moment. It's quite a new relationship. I mean, I think it is, you know, it is serious. You know, Prince Harry has been photographed with her, and normally that's quite a key, you know, when they start going out for dinner dates and get photographed, and they're okay with that. That normally means that it is getting serious. But, you know, Prince Harry's previous girlfriend, Chelsea Davy, apparently that did come to an end because she wasn't willing to become a member of the royal family. So, I mean, it affects on the face of the relationship just as much as on the girl herself.
I suppose if you are marrying one of the major royals, your life will change differently. You can't really walk down to the local corner shop to get a pint of milk. Your picture's going to be everywhere. I mean, Catherine the other week with grey hairs. There were full-page spreadouts about that.
I feel so sorry for Catherine. Obviously, you know, she isn't able to do her hair at the moment where she's, I assume she's breastfeeding and everything. So, you know, she's, yeah, the criticism. But I think it does change your life dramatically. You know, Catherine obviously has to now take up public service and dedicate her whole life to, you know, the country and to William. And so, yes, yeah, so really her life becomes, you know, so dedicated to the royal family that I think it's extremely hard. I mean, this week, Catherine kind of feels a level of criticism towards her when her dress blew up. So just everything, every little thing is, you know, a target, really.
Would you marry a royal, Jordan, if you could?
I think I would. It comes with a lot of privilege and a lot of responsibility as well. I think we live in a very modern era, and I think William and Kate have been able to have quite a private relationship that maybe Charles and Diana weren't allowed.
Jordan, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much. That's Jordan Lee Squibb, Deputy Editor of royalcentral.co.uk. I'm Ian Lee, here until 12 o'clock. Then Daz takes over from midday until 2. Right, what have we got here? Talking about finding money. What would you do if you found some money on the floor? Would you hand it in or would you pocket it yourself? Mark's in King Standing. Morning, Mark.
Morning, Ian.
Mark, what happened to you?
When I was a kid, about 8 or 9, way back in the early 70s, I found a wage packet. And when I took it home, I didn't open it. I took it home, showed me dad. There was no pay slip in it.
Yeah.
But there was £45, which was an awful lot of money then.
I bet it was, yes.
And my dad took me up with the wage packet to Haymills Police Station, which is now a pub, funny enough, yeah, called the Bill and Ball. Anyway, we handed it in and we filled all the forms in. And weeks later, I think it was about 12 weeks later, we got a letter off the police telling us to go back to the police station. Nobody had claimed it, and they gave it money.
So that's the cut-off, isn't it? I think it is 3 months.
I think so.
Yeah, and if no one claims it, you get to keep it. You must have been over the moon.
Well, it was actually more than my dad earned.
Right. Wow, wow. And who got to keep it? You?
My dad gave it me.
Wow.
My dad gave it
to me. How old were you?
I was about 8 or 9.
8 or 9, and got £45 in the early 70s.
It was an absolute fortune.
You could have bought 3 houses with that.
Probably could.
Mark, thank you very much for that. Stephen's in Kingsbury. Morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning, Ian. Yeah.
What would you like to say?
It's quite a similar story to Mark's, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always instilled honesty in my children. Similar story again. My lad was about 10. He's now 30. And him and his friends found a load of paper money going down the high street in Coleshill. Obviously, he fell out of somebody, and he was windblown down the high street.
Yeah.
And it amounted to about £60 or £70. And of course, they were most you know, happy about this and joyful and what they're going to spend it on. And I just reminded him, it may well have belonged to, you know, a pensioner or his pension or somebody who really needed that money. you know, it could have been a weekly allowance or anything, somebody dependent, children, etc. And anyway, he saw the sense in what I was saying, and he's a good lad at heart. And once again, same as Mark, we went to the police station and handed it in and filled the forms in. And likewise, got a call back about a month later. Nobody claimed it. But nevertheless, he'd done the right thing. Yep. And to this day, he's just as honest. And that's a really...
Well, well done you. It sounds like you're doing a cracking job. And it does feel a little bit better, you know, when you've done the right thing and yet you still get it back. I don't know, Stephen, if I lost 60 quid, I don't know if I'd even consider going to the police station to see if anyone handed it in.
No, it's an issue because unfortunately people think, well, I'm never going to see that again. But there are a lot of honest people there still.
Stephen, I appreciate that. Thank you very much indeed. We've got another 10 minutes of the show if you want to give us a call on that. 08453 009956. Now, how do you like your coffee? I'm off coffee. I've stopped. I was drinking far too much of it and I've stopped. Well, there are some people who like a bit of milk, a bit of sugar. There are some people who do art with coffee. I know it sounds ridiculous, but apparently some people do. I'm joined by Birmingham artist Paul Parkin, otherwise known as Jinxy, who uses coffee as his very own paint, and he's due to open his own gallery in the Custard Factory in Digbeth. Morning, Jinxy.
How are you?
Come a little bit closer to the microphone. Yeah, I'm very well, thank you very much. Now, listen, when I was told we've got an artist coming in, he's doing pictures with coffee, I thought, flipping heck, really?
Another one.
Yeah, no, and yet you've brought them in. They're amazing. What's this one we've got here? It looks incredible.
It's just obviously a young ballet dancer just tying her shoes.
And you got the queen over there.
Oh yeah, it's got to do a bit of royalty.
Why a little bit of royalty? A bit of class to the show been lacking all morning, Jinxy. Why coffee? When did you discover this?
Well, I was painting at one stage and I spilled a tiny bit of coffee, and as it was drying, I'd done four little flicks with it and a little thumb, and made a little hand. And when it dried, it came out like a perfect, perfect hand. I'm not saying this was a calling.
Yeah.
But it was actually perfect. I was looking at it for ages. It was quite amazing, which was like 10 seconds work.
Yeah.
And
but to go from that, though, to go from a little moment, oh, that was fun.
Oh,
instead of pushing it to one side, you went, oh, actually, there is something more in this.
Well, I drew an arm and a leg.
Yeah. And that's how it happened.
Yeah, well, it's interesting for any artist because when you work on different surfaces, it reacts different. So every little picture is on a complete challenge to yourself.
How many pictures have you done with coffee?
Only two, but I only started Tuesday. Nah.
Really?
Nah, I've got quite a few.
I was going to say, you've not done the Queen since Tuesday. That looks like a bit more time.
I've done about... 500, 400, something around about that.
Wow. Is it satisfying to work with?
Yeah, because it's a challenge all the time.
Yeah.
You know, they, like I say, when on different surfaces, they react totally different. So every time you do a new picture, it's a new challenge.
Now, is there a kind of coffee that you prefer? Is it Nespresso? Is it Nescafe? Where are you getting it from and what is it?
Usually the cheapest I can get.
Really?
But they do vary, even the different coffees, you know. But
what's the best coffee? If you want to do a portrait of me now, what? And I want a really high class one.
You look like a Nescafe man to myself.
Oh, that's a bit disappointing. I mean, it's all right. I was expecting something a little bit more classy. Maybe one of those pods or something. And you've got an exhibition coming up.
Yeah, I got one on at the moment at the Custard Factory.
Okay, and how many? What kind of things can people see there if they want to go along?
Just the various styles in which, you know, the medium can be used.
Yeah. So what are the various styles? Is not all just brush?
No, I mean, by pouring water on it, it creates effects. There's a few Bob Marley pictures there, but his actual dreadlocks are just, coffee with water poured on, which intertwindle and they start moving. At the end of the day, it's just like millions and millions of tiny little particles of coffee, and it's just the way that you manipulate them.
I hate people who can sing really well, and I hate people who are really good artists.
I can sing.
I don't. I hate people who are good artists just because I'm so jealous, because I can't. I can't draw to save my life. And I look at something like that picture, the portrait you've got of the Queen there, and whatever that was done in, that is incredible. How long did it take you to do that?
It's probably about 15, 20 hours, isn't it?
Wow.
There's a lot of drawing time with them as well, consequently. Yeah.
I suppose
because you can't overwork. It's not. It's like a medium on its own. It's not like a watercolour where you can overlay and brush off.
Mm. If it all goes pear-shaped, I suppose, you can just run some water on it and drink it, can you? Is that?
Yeah.
Would that be feasible?
They're all resined and afterwards like to...
Does it work with anything else? Have you tried tea? Have you tried Tizer, Iron Brew?
I can paint it with most things, to be honest. I've done wine labels out of wine.
Really?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Which work as well.
Yeah.
But you can make art out of anything, really.
And when people see your art for the first time, your coffee art, what's their reaction generally?
Pretty amazing, really. Most people.
Yeah. Are you the only artist working in coffee at the moment?
Obviously, when one does one, you know, does something for themselves, you think nobody else does. But I'm sure, like, there must be some people out there that do it as well, you know?
Mm. So if people want to come and see and then we're going to put some of these pictures up on the BBC WM website, probably straight after this show, we'll make sure that those pictures got there. Because they do, I know, you're talking about art, well, what does it look like? Go to the WM website, they'll be up in a few minutes. They look amazing. So what other pictures are you going to have on display at this this exhibition, or have you got
it's
on display?
Probably about 25, 30 up there at the moment.
Right.
From balls to...
From balls.
Balls.
Oh, okay, balls. Okay, right, yes.
That's another story.
Yes.
But, I can't remember what's up there now, but there's quite a few of these birds and...
Mm. Do you drink much coffee?
Only if it doesn't work, and then I just pour some water over and pour it into
See, I've gone off coffee. I can't drink that stuff at all. I was drinking too much of it. It's bad for you.
Well, there is that, yeah, but, well...
Listen, give the plug... It looks amazing. If people want to see the pictures, it'll be on the WM website straight after the show. Paul Jinksy, give the exhibition a plug again. Where and when and how long is it going on for?
Well, that's at the Custard Factory, but I've got a permanent gallery there anyway.
Yeah.
And it's on there. Obviously, I've got an open day today, but they can come any time of the
week. Thank you so much for bringing it in.
And you
didn't come on the bus with that, did you?
No. Okay. We walked.
I see you have a glamorous assistant with you. You can do the carrying. Good for you.
Yeah, it's nice to have a nice daughter.
Jinxy, listen, best of luck. I'm genuine. I think it's amazing. So thank you very much, and best of luck with that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can you do anything
it's
like that?
Extraordinary. Well, I did the classic at school and got in detention when we were doing art, and I just painted the paper black and said it was Lichfield by night. Now, if Damien Hirst does that, he's a genius.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. It's the context, isn't it? You can be called...
Leaves his cheese sandwich and everyone says, oh, that's great. Mate,
£500,000.
Yeah, I get told about children in Ethiopia if I left mine as a kid.
Daz, listen, it's nice to see you again. You're going to be talking about football again, aren't you?
Yeah, well, that sort of stuff, yeah. We're building up to the big games in early kickoff. Plenty of banter, plenty of mucking about as well. So this afternoon from 12 o'clock, best strike partnership at your club over the years. And also, if you could change one law or introduce a new law into the game, what would it be? Serious or funny?
This is genuinely, I think this is a good idea, and I don't know why anyone has taken this up. This will make football more exciting. You call it super soccer or double football. You have a square pitch. You have four goals. You have four teams playing.
Okay, so that's about four different rules, but I like it.
It would work.
We'll go with that. You know what mine is?
Yeah.
Any footballer wearing short sleeves and gloves, straight red card. We're not having that. Hey, can I tell you my daughter's Doctor Who joke?
You've been
on about Doctor Who. Again, it's not something that I got into first time, although I have started watching it with my daughter.
Yeah.
And she's eight, and she's got a joke.
Does she get scared by it?
No, I think I don't think we ever did that. I think we just used to pretend to, didn't we?
Oh, I got proper scared by the Daleks. Yeah.
Tom Baker was he was John Pertwee. The boy was sort of was Wurzel Gummidge, you see. So I could never quite get the John Pertwee.
Yeah, no, Tom Baker was menacing. It was an awe about him.
Yeah,
go on, tell us your daughter's joke.
So my daughter's joke is, what does Doctor Who have with his pizza?
Go on.
Dalek bread.
Hey, that's
genius.
Not bad.
Hey, come on.
She's good.
I blame the parents.
Daz, listen, thank you very much. Nice to see you. You'll be on from 12 o'clock. 08453-009956 is the phone number if you want to take part in that. Jinxy, just give us one more time. Just give us a plug of where people can come and see your rocks. I know that people will want to have a look at it.
The Custard Factory, which is in Digbeth.
Yep. I can come down and have a look.
Of course.
And we're going to put some of it up on the BBC WM website as well. Thank you very much for coming
in this
morning.
That's very kind of
you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much as well, everyone who took part. Very quickly, I've had an email. We were talking about sending off your kids and your grandchildren to other places of faith that maybe weren't their religion. There's been a few, people who weren't that happy about the idea of sending their relatives off. Mohammed says on the email, Ian, we Muslims, when we pray in the mosque, we don't carry prayer mats. The mosque is carpeted throughout. People would not be accepted into the mosque if you were forced. We respect Jesus, and Muslims don't want to ban Christmas. We just don't celebrate it. Thank you very much for that. That's it. That's your lot. Who knows who's going to be in this slot next week? Fingers crossed Nick will be up and fighting fit again. He's got glandular fever, which is not fun at all. Thank you very much to everyone who took part, all of the phone calls, all of the arguments, all of the texts and the emails. Sorry we didn't get through all of them. Right, it's coming up to midday. I better shut up because here comes the news.